Wait, so much.
I'm great. Committee on Judiciary, come to order.
And the Senate Committee on Judiciary as a subcommittee will come to order.
We are going to adopt House rules a little later on. I'd first like to start out by welcoming Representative Vega Peterson, who's joining the Judiciary. And it'll be an asset to the committee, and we will be sorry to see her. And Multnomah County will be happy to see her become a commissioner.
Doesn't she drive a Mini Cooper?
She drives a Mini Cooper. Oh. One of the couple of people who drive them. Information. Okay. We'll open an informational meeting on a report from the Task Force on Immigration Consultant Fraud. Representative Peterson, Vega Peterson. And Aaron Noddy, Representative Vega Peterson, please.
It's like hazing my first turn. All right, Chair Przanski, Chair Barker, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Jessica Vega Peterson. I'm the state representative in House District 47 in East Portland. I'm here to give a report on the Task Force on Immigration Consultant Fraud. And just to give you a little bit of background, last session the legislature passed House Bill 3425, which established the Immigration Consultant Fraud Task Force, which was co-chaired by Senator Sarah Gelser and myself. And unfortunately, because of illness, she couldn't be here today. So I'm going to give the report on her behalf. I'm also joined by Aaron Knox, DOJ. He's here to be the lawyer and answer all the technical questions. So the task force dealt with the issue of unlawful immigration consultants, often known as notarios, and sought to find ways to amend the current statutes to give law enforcement tools to adequately combat this problem. The task force created a report, which you'll find on OLIS, and it's my pleasure today to give you a summary of the work that we did. So to start off, notarial fraud is where someone is unlawfully renting themselves as an immigration consultant. Under ORS 9.280, only lawyers and federally authorized representatives can provide advice on immigration matters. And notaries in the state are regulated by the Secretary of State's Corporate Division, and they are only authorized to witness the signing of documents and to administer oaths. But there's a problem that's arisen in many immigrant communities where individuals obtain a notary license and advertise themselves as a notario, which in many Latin American countries is actually a figure similar to an attorney. So though the legislature has previously prohibited notarios or notario publicos by anyone but an immigration attorney, we still have a problem with unlawful notarios being active across the state. They claim to do the work of immigration or tax attorneys, and they prey on immigrant communities or the communities unfamiliar with our U.S. legal system. They are charging their victims anywhere from hundreds to thousands of dollars for immigration assistance that they don't have the license to provide, and they regularly re-victimize those that they have already taken advantage of by threatening with harm if they seek help or they seek to report their actions. There have been reports of notarios demanding additional money, holding important legal documents as ransom, or threatening to report clients or clients' family members to authorities. So this issue was brought before myself and Representative Gallegos after the fall of 2014 when the Oregon State Bar hosted a conference on the issue. It became clear that this was an issue statewide across Oregon and that a new approach was needed to give law enforcement the tools to combat this fraud. Dick Ginsburg, an immigration lawyer and long-term community advocate, called an informal work group that began discussions on possible legislation. Based on the results of that informal work group, Rep. Gallegos and I submitted House Bill 3525, which would have amended ORS 162.235, which is the Judicial Administration Obstruction Statute. After discussions during the session, it became clear that more discussion was needed on this, so we changed that to a task force, and the result of the task force is what you have before you today. So this task force was made up of 9 individuals, Amber Hollister from the Oregon State Bar Association, John Mirandis, who's joining us, and as an immigration attorney, Judy Parker from the Oregon Advocacy Commission's office, Aaron Knott from the Department of Justice, Stephanie Engelsman from the Oregon Criminal Defense Attorneys, John Haroldson representing Oregon prosecutors, Bonnie Allen Saylor representing the low-wage workers, Keith Bickford from the Multnomah County Detective's Office representing law enforcement, Shenpone Silenpase representing the advocacy group for immigrants and refugees, Senator Gelser and myself, as well as Peter Threckle from the Secretary of State's Corporate Division. And we were also ably staffed by Nancy Kramer, who is also here today. We met 3 times on August 18th, September 2nd, and September 17th. And during those meetings, we reviewed the current statutes and explored amendments to criminal and civil regulatory statutes. We discussed providing law enforcement with improved tools to fight notarial fraud and also expanding the Secretary of State's regulatory authority over notaries who engage in unlawful practice of law. We analyzed notarial fraud statutes in 11 other states, which revealed that these other states recognize the devastating impacts that notarial fraud has on vulnerable communities and that they are actively seeking tools to combat this fraud. There's an appendix in the report on OLIS that lists recently enacted notarial fraud legislation that you're welcome to peruse. Based on the discussions that we had, there were 3 different recommendations that we had for amending statute. The first was to amend ORS 164.075, theft by extortion. The second was to amend ORS 194.315 and ORS 194.340, which is the regulation of notaries by the Secretary of State. And also a discussion was had on amending ORS 162.235, the obstruction of justice. And as well as these recommendations to change statutes, we also recommend continued education of vulnerable communities about this issue as well as law enforcement. I'm now going to turn the microphone over to Aaron Knott, who's going to discuss the proposals in more detail and be able to answer some of your technical questions.
Chair Barker, Chair Prusansky, members of the committee, my name is Aaron Knott. I'm the legislative director for the Oregon Department of Justice and Attorney General. So the problem of notarial fraud is it fits under one umbrella, but it has discrete phases during the life of this crime type. What I mean by that is you have somebody who's holding themselves out, first of all, to be able to perform immigration services that they're not qualified to perform. So that by itself is already a problem. They're actively deceiving members of the community as an ongoing sort of fake concern. Just by the fact of their operation. Then when somebody walks in, the nature of the deception changes. They make a specific representation saying, okay, I can do this for you, give me money. Now at that point, they've deceived somebody into giving them property. That's yet another phase of crime. And often, that person eventually finds out that this notario has no ability to file their immigration documents, that they've essentially been conned. And when they go back angry, then you encounter yet another phase of criminality, which is when that notario looks at the person that they've defrauded and says some variant of, if you tell anybody about this, I'll see to it that you're deported, which is a fact pattern that we see pretty commonly in these kinds of cases when people who are defrauded try to get their money back. And so the real task of this group was to do a survey of our existing library of crime, sort of stern to stem, and see where we needed to make some fixes. So to go through those briefly one at a time. The first, when you have a going operation that is in the business of defrauding, we analyze placing the fix there, and this is different order than what's in the report, but I think it makes sense, in obstructing governmental or judicial administration. That's a Class A misdemeanor. And the proposal to put it in there reflects the fact that when the business is operating to basically emulate a governmental or quasi-governmental function, the victim here is the state. It's sort of the order of society. It's not at that moment a discrete victim. So this gives us the ability to go in and have some tools to shut these places down without actually waiting for them to defraud unknown numbers of people. It gives us some affirmative tools to intervene early and on a lower level of crime seriousness. Now, at the second point, when they actually take money from somebody by deceiving them about what they're capable of doing, there's a law that we already have that's squarely on point, and we made no modifications to it. That law is theft by deception. And that's when you represent to somebody that you can do something that you can't do in order to extract money from them, knowing at the time that you do it that you have no ability to help them. It's a fraud. That's one of your fraud statutes. So we left that one alone. That's typically a more serious offense. But then the final aspect of the fact pattern was the most, on some, I'd say the most interesting and the most complex, which is what happens when you're threatened. When somebody goes in and says, you ripped me off, and the response is, I'm going to harm you, I'm going to have you deported, I'm going to report you to the police. What happens there? Because that's a very particular, very narrow type of harm. So we looked, as Representative Vega Peterson said, at 11 different states and the way that they structure things. And what we learned about Oregon is that our theft by extortion statute, which would normally be the closest fit, is a very narrow and on some levels odd statute. And what I mean by it being odd is an extortion is different than a normal theft because it's effectuated by some sort of a threat against you. It's, you know, they don't pick your pocket. They don't rob you either. They basically say, I'm going to harm you in some way if you don't give me what I want. So in that level, it's in between a theft and a robbery. They're not using force. But what was interesting about this is at the point that one of these notarios says to a person, I will turn you in if you push this any further, they've already committed the theft. And so you can't have a theft twice. So our existing theft by extortion statute did not work. And so that started the process of us trying to figure out how to make this fit better. When we looked at other states, what we learned is that their versions of extortion are often broader. You can be extorted out of services. You can be extorted if just to get a material benefit from that person, as long as you have that use of force. That narrow requirement of just property is very specific to Oregon. So what we proposed was to take theft by extortion and broaden it into something more akin to extortion, recognizing that you can indeed be extorted out of more than property. Specifically here, we've got the discussion of services. That's something you can be extorted out of. You can be compelled to do something of value for somebody that you did not want to, or to gain the benefit of that person not being able to go to law enforcement because you've essentially terrified them out of doing it. So those are your three life cycle of the notario phases. We also proposed a change to the civil and regulatory framework under the Secretary of State. There are concerns raised that you can engage in notario fraud, we can even know about it, and you could potentially, under some circumstances, recertify it as a notary down the line. So we made some changes that are very simple and very common sense that make it clear that if you engage in this conduct, this is not something you will ever be permitted to do. That door will be closed to you, and the Secretary of State will have the discretion to deny any application for a notary if you have those prior adjudications or convictions. So that's just a brief overview. Happy to answer any technical questions.
Any questions? Thank you very much.
Thank you.
I'm going to go back in the agenda to the adoption of committee rules. These are the same rules we've had in the past.
Can I comment?
Yeah.
As a matter of form, I think the second paragraph that starts, the quorum shall be comprised of the majority, I think that's poor grammatic use. A quorum shall comprise a majority or can be composed of a majority. I don't propose to be changing it. I just want to put on the record my objection to it.
Thank you. We'll get a change next time.
Mr. Chair, I'd like to associate myself with that grammar correction.
But that's in the House rules, not the Senate rules.
Chair Barker, I move to adopt the proposed committee rules dated September 30th, 2015.
Representative Langer moves to adopt the proposed committee rules dated September 30th, 2015. Is there any discussion? Are there any objections? Seeing none, so ordered. The rules are adopted.
And we need to do the same for adoption of our committee rules. And so, Senator Cruz,
Bang the gavel.
How's that? Okay. That make it better?
Yeah, that does make it better. I respond to hammers very well. Mr. Chair, I move to adopt the proposed committee rules dated September 30th, 2015.
Senator Cruz moves to adopt the proposed committee rules dated September 30th, 2015. Is there any discussion? Senator Burdick, did you want to check to see if we had a grammar issue
Mr.
on our
Chair,
side?
Mr. Chair, I just checked it, and I would like Representative Greenlink to know that another way to say it is you could say the committee shall constitute a quorum.
Mm-hmm. Which is what the Senate rules say.
You said comprise, or the other word you used was comprise. You said
composed of.
Yes. You can also say constitute.
Yes.
So that's what the Senate rules say.
Yes.
So if you need to borrow a copy of the Senate rules for to make that change on the House side, we'll make sure our staff helps you out there.
We'll borrow them in February.
All right.
Mr. Chair, with consideration, of course.
Well, of course. All right. Any other discussion? Are there any objections to the motion that Senator Cruz has moved to adopt the proposed committee rules dated September 30th, 2015? Not seeing any. There not being any objections, that is adopted and passed. Thank you. So we'll close the, I guess this is considered our adoption of mineral rules segment, and we're back on to our informational hearing. Chair Barker.
Thank you. Next item on the agenda is the review of isolation practice by the Oregon Youth Authority. Mr. O'Leary and Aaron
Aaron Fuimaono. I had to practice that a few times before appearing in front of the committee myself. I'm also
vowels,
very concerned
vowels,
about the potential grammar of the PowerPoint presentation. So I'll ask your forgiveness in advance.
We have a red pencil, Joe.
For the record, my name is Joe O'Leary, Deputy Director of the Oregon Youth Authority. It's a pleasure to appear in front of you today, along with our Director of Facilities Operations, Aaron Fuimaono. We're here to talk to you today about a really important issue in juvenile justice, and that is the use of isolation. And it may take me a moment here to make sure I know how to. There we go. This is our overview that we're going to walk you through. We're going to talk to you about what isolation is under administrative rule in Oregon and OIA policy. We're going to talk to you about some concerns and the evolution of those concerns. Things we're doing to prevent and reduce the use of isolation. We'll share with you some data to help you get your heads around the issue. And then we're going to talk to you about challenges and opportunities for the future. Okay. Interesting. Pardon me while I try to bring this back. There. All right. Thank you.
Full service.
Yeah, indeed. It's appreciated. The definition of isolation under Oregon administrative rules and under OIA policy is pretty straightforward. Key elements here: alone, locked room, and due to the youth's behavior or conduct. Several of you have been to the McLaren Youth Facility, Youth Correctional Facility, and some of our other facilities. You've seen the intervention unit. You've seen the rooms that we have utilized historically for isolation. So I want to stress, I'm about to walk you through the policy, and what I want to stress about the policy and the administrative rule is that is the current policy and administrative rule, and it is very much something that is undergoing transformation, which is one of the reasons we wanted to talk to you. So very quickly, the highlights of the administrative rule and policy are as follows. The grounds for an isolation placement are limited to danger to self, danger to others, or immediate threat to safety or order of the facility. The administrative rule clarifies that isolation is not to be used for punishment. There's a cap on isolation under the administrative rule. It cannot extend more than 5 days consecutively. And it also says that the placement must be, under the rule, the minimum amount of time needed to obtain the re-regulation of the youth. And just as a side, you know, working in a youth correctional facility is a tough job. And being in a youth correctional facility as a youth is a tough thing. You've seen, several of you have seen our facilities themselves. We're going to talk to you about some of the improvements to the physical plants that we're undergoing. But you can picture, I think, a 25-bed unit of, you know, we can have them as young as 12. The court can impose that. But, you know, think 15 or so up to early 20s youth with, at the most robust staffing levels, 3 staff, where there's no other place to go except in that unit, which, as those of you who have visited know, they're pretty small. And when there are fights, when there is tension, there's often not a place to go. We have, I think, done a really good job, actually, with our policy. And then the next slide I'm going to show you, we're actually ahead of a lot of states in the fact that we have a cap. We say no punishment. It's not used for punishment. And we have some limitations on its use. And we guarantee due process and access to education, mental health treatment, other treatment services while the placement occurs. That all said, we have room for improvement. And the reason we know we have room for improvement is because in the national conversation, the developmental science is pretty clear, particularly with respect to the adolescent brain, that isolation can be harmful. And the last thing we want to do as the youth correctional agency, as juvenile justice agency, is make the young people that are committed to our custody worse or more likely to reoffend or less likely to be productive and successful once they leave our care. So acknowledging some of these risks around isolation, we have been participating in that national conversation, which is a pretty robust national conversation. I'm not going to go through these points. I will give you these slides for your records. Suffice it to say, there's been a lot of meetings, conversations, conferences, webinars, and OIA has participated in those as listeners, and we've also participated actually in those as providers of technical assistance to other states who are trying to improve their own practices around this issue. With that, I'm ahead of myself. I think it's my time to turn it over to Aaron, who is going to walk you through some of the history around our practice and tell you about some of the things we're up to now.
Chair Przanski, Chair Barker, members of the committee, I appreciate the opportunity to talk with you today about some of the work the OIA is doing around reducing and preventing the use of isolation. Like all practices in human services, OIA's isolation policy and practices have evolved over time as we learn more about what works in achieving our desired outcomes. And so I'm focusing today really just on our most recent history. Towards the beginning of our understanding that isolation was likely not moving us toward our desired outcomes, which are youth who are accountable and also leave us with the skills to be safe, productive citizens and neighbors.
And could you identify yourself for the record?
Sure. So for the record, my name is Erin Fuimaono. You just wanted to hear me say it, right?
So you could pronounce it. That's right.
I'm the Chief of Operations for the Oregon Youth Authority Facility Services.
Thank you.
So as Joe mentioned, OIA's policy does prohibit the use of isolation as punishment, which is different than many states in the nation. And that predates the timeline that I have here, actually. So for many years, we have prohibited the use of isolation as punishment. In 2010, we did limit the use of isolation to no more than 5 days, and that aligned us with the American Correctional Association standards for juvenile corrections. And it's interesting to note that we still exceed the ACA's standards regarding use of isolation as punishment. The ACA still deems the use of disciplinary sanction as appropriate for offenses. In December of 2012, we closed a statewide behavior management unit that housed the state's most aggressive and assaultive youth. And it was heavily reliant on short-term isolation as a behavior management strategy. But we were not seeing the desired outcomes from that program, which in this case was reduced violent behavior. And we also at that time were becoming much more aware of the research and national conversation around the impact of isolation on adolescent development. And so in closing that program, we repurposed the positions and resources that were allocated to the program to develop skill development coordinator positions and disperse them throughout four of our facilities. Those are staff that are trained, have additional training in collaborative problem solving and emotion management and positive human development, and they work proactively with our most behaviorally challenging youth on problem-solving strategies and emotion regulation to hopefully reduce the number of behaviors that those youth exhibit that might require isolation. That brings us kind of to where we are currently, and we have a number of agency initiatives that are informing our review of isolation practices. The overarching initiative is the development of a positive human development culture throughout the agency. Positive human development focuses on creating optimal environments to support really healthy brain development. My notes say healthy adolescent brain development, and this really stems from the research around positive youth development. But the more that we became familiar with it, the more we recognized that optimal environments for brain development really are optimal environments for supporting humans. So it's very important to us that in developing this culture, we're making the right environment for our youth and for our staff. And what we know is that creating an environment that supports healthy brain development really gives us the best opportunity to affect positive change in young people. What we also know is that isolation is not conducive to positive human development or positive brain development. So as we are focused on moving a positive human development culture forward in the agency, we're committed to the prevention and reduction of the use of isolation. So within that context of positive human development, we're engaged in several isolation-specific efforts, the first of which was the convening of an internal isolation and reintegration oversight committee in October of 2014. And that committee is focused on redefining when and how youth may be placed in isolation based on national best practices and research, on identifying resources to support those recommended changes so they can be implemented and sustained as designed, and to align related OIA policies, rules, and practices to those recommendations. Shortly after the implementation of the internal committee, we convened an external committee of stakeholders and content experts in juvenile corrections, mental health, and advocacy groups, and have asked for their oversight and feedback on our internal committee's recommendations. Currently, that community advisory group includes representation from Youth Rights and Justice, Disability Rights Oregon, Partnership for Safety and Justice, a child psychiatrist, a judge, juvenile detention manager, district attorney, the American Civil Liberties Union, and the Commission on Black Affairs. And a public defender. And most recently, we have been working with what we call the Isolation Definition Implementation Work Group. So as Joe alluded to when he talked about our current definition and kind of threshold for isolation, our internal oversight committee is looking at making revisions to that definition and threshold, and they in fact have made some initial recommendations. The recommendations are not final, but there are elements of it that we know will be part of the final product, and we also know that, it represents a significant practice change for us, and so we wanted to get ahead of that. So we gathered this isolation definition implementation work group, whose job it is to develop recommendations for alternative interventions to address behaviors that will no longer meet the recommended revised definition and threshold for isolation. We collect a lot of data in our agency, and we look at a lot of data related to our use of isolation and to help inform our decision making as we review our policies and practices. So this is just a sample of kind of what we look at on a regular basis. One is just the number of isolation episodes in any given time period. So this chart shows you from 2011 to present that our use of isolation has continued to decline as our focus on a more proactive approach increases. This slide looks at duration, which is also something that we pay a lot of attention to. Our intention is to have isolation episodes be as short in duration as possible. So once a youth is re-regulated, we want to start a process for reintegrating that youth with his or her living unit community, including the staff and the youth that may have been impacted by that youth's behavior. So this chart shows you that in July of 2015, 74% of our isolation episodes were ended within 24 hours. And a final example of some of the data that we look at on a regular basis is this shows that the youth that are accounting for isolation incidents. So this chart goes from 2008 to 2014. If you just focus on the bar for 2014, it's telling us that 20% of the youth account for 73% of our isolation episodes. So that really helps us in determining where to focus our resources to be most effective on reducing and preventing isolation. So our skill development coordinator positions are focused on that 20% and doing that proactive problem solving to reduce the need for isolation. And we're also currently working on developing a unit-based community and program to better address this group's specific needs. Some of the major challenges we have in looking at our issues around isolation or our use of isolation is that we have a physical plant and a staffing ratio that was built at a time when isolation was seen as the most appropriate, effective behavior management tool in juvenile corrections, really in corrections across the board. So our physical plants are not built to allow us to, or allow a youth to take space if he or she is starting to feel dysregulated. There's either a group living in environment or isolation, and there's no in between. Our staffing is kind of also built that way. So we don't have a staffing pattern that allows one staff to spend an extended amount of time with one youth, helping that youth re-regulate or calm down or go on a walk. We have enough staff to supervise and react to issues and conflicts, but not enough to really proactively manage conflicts or youth who are becoming dysregulated. The other biggest challenge is that we are in the midst of two very monumental culture changes in our agency, and culture change, really to do culture change right, takes time. So reducing the use of isolation is a huge culture change in juvenile justice across the nation. As I said, it's been a practice and tool in all of corrections since the beginning of corrections. So asking people to look at alternatives for isolation requires a lot of shifting mindsets, especially because we almost exclusively use isolation for assaultive or aggressive behavior. Safety is a major concern of ours and our staffs. Our staffs are concerned about how to maintain their own safety, and they're also concerned with how to maintain the safety of the other youth in their care without the use of isolation. And that's a primary human need, and so we're very, very aware that any alternatives that we suggest cannot be at the expense of the safety of our staff and our youth. The other major change that's happening in Oregon is this move towards positive human development, which is really a shift from a more punitive approach and model to a developmental model. And that, again, takes a lot of cognitive flexibility on the part of our staff. And so what we know about culture change is that implementing something that is true change and sustainable is slow and incremental, and as I said, can't be at the expense of things as primary to us as people as safety. So we need to make very small changes in the direction that we're trying to go and recognize that those are going to take time and lots of adjustment to take hold.
We also have a lot of opportunities. And again, for the record, this is Joe O'Leary. Aaron spoke about the culture change, and the accompaniment to that culture change is something that the legislature approved In this last session, you approved $50 million in bonding for the Oregon Youth Authority to physically change our close custody environments, to move them away from, as they many of them were built, this correctional, punitive, adult sort of model to a developmentally appropriate treatment and education while still secure model. That funding over the next, certainly a lot is going to happen over the next 2 years. Two of our biggest facilities are going to merge, McLaren and Hillcrest. With the merging into the McLaren campus, I know that the building that you toured, several of you toured during session that I alluded to, our intervention unit where there are isolation cells, that building is going to be knocked down. And there's not going to be one of those anymore. We are building new units that are designed with this culture in mind, a culture that will have physical spaces that meet the philosophical idea behind it, and cooling off spaces and program spaces and the ability to go outside and take some space when the heated moments that all of us have in our living environments, but that, as you can imagine, are a little bit more intense in a setting with 25 young men or women and a handful of staff. We're going to try to bring down our youth to staff ratio as well, which we think will enhance the ability of staff to manage those kinds of interactions that are going to happen. We also find great hope in this isolation work group. This has been something now going on where I'm really thrilled that so many of our community partners are helping us and collaborating with us in this effort. We're also thrilled that the legislature included a budget note for us to report back on in February about the work of that work group. And the final teaser here is we do expect, I noted that the current policy is an administrative rule. What I didn't say is that there's no statute on isolation, at least not with respect to youth correctional facilities. And it very well may be that the work of this alternatives work group comes up with some recommendations that you may wish to consider codifying. So to the extent you have the ability, the governor has actually given us the green light to go ahead and seek out a vehicle in February, if not February, hopefully next time around, where we can enshrine something into statute that makes sense. So that is our presentation. I hope we kept it close to time, and happy to answer any questions.
Questions? Representative Springer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Maybe I missed it when I had to step out, but I'm interested to see some data on staffing injuries as a result of contact with youth, not slipping on the steps in the snow.
Chair Przanski, Chair Barker, Representative Springer, members of the committee, you did not miss that. We didn't bring that data, but we certainly could put that together for you.
Follow up, Mr. Chair.
Please.
Do you have any idea what those numbers might reflect percentage-wise? I mean, very, very few injuries or quite a few injuries? I think that's a telling number for us.
Representative Springer, I don't know the exact percentage off the top of my head. My guess, or my educated guess, is that it is more than very few, but not many.
Okay. So,
qualitative range.
Follow up on that vagueness. I'd like to. Is there a chance those are numbers that would be available maybe in the next few days?
Absolutely.
That'd be great. Thank you.
Yeah, and then to reassure Chair Barker and Chair Przanski, Representative Springer, we actually meet as a leadership team quarterly with all of our facilities management and our parole and probation management. We actually review key data points every quarter, and these are, we have an agency scorecard that actually tracks these kinds of things. So these are at our fingertips, but we didn't have them in the presentation. Easy to get to you, though.
Thank you.
Thank you. Anything further? Any further questions? Okay. Thank you,
thank
very,
you
much.
Very much.
And the next is a report from a work group on unmanned aircraft systems. Mitch Swicker, Kenji Sugihara, and Kimberly McCullough, please. Please go ahead and just be sure to introduce yourself for the record.
Chair Barker, Senator Przanski, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Mitch Swicker. I'm the director of the Oregon Department of Aviation. And we're here to give you an update on the work of the stakeholders group for the unmanned aircraft systems. And that group consists of law enforcement folks, the industry, some state representatives, staffs, and the amateur community as well, and ACLU here with Kimberly McCullough. So we've divided into subgroups as well. We have an economic development subgroup, we have a law enforcement and privacy subgroup, and we have an education, registration, and safety subgroup. And we'll talk just a little bit about some of that. And we haven't come to definitive outcomes yet, but we did want to update you today and let you know where we are, and then get feedback and direction if you have any on actions you'd like to see for 16 or 17.
Chair Barker, Chair Przanski, members of the committee, my name is Kenji Sugihara. I'm the executive director of the Oregon Bicycle Racing Association, also an Oregon Tourism Commissioner, but for the record, I'm here because I'm a drone nerd. To continue with the presentation, unmanned aircraft systems, or UAS, are aircraft that don't have a pilot in or on them. Generally, they're classified in two distinct categories, above 55 pounds and below 55 pounds. They can generally, hobbyist models can be bought anywhere, including on Amazon.com, at hobby stores, even at Walmart. You can even buy a Millennium Falcon drone these days. They are basically put into three different categories. They're hobby, which include the Phantom 3 and others that you might see just general people using. And then commercial, which are used for like line inspections, agriculture, and other commercial purposes. And then, of course, there's public use, which includes law enforcement or firefighters. And then there's also military applications, too.
So one of the things we wanted to do is to kind of give you an update on where the federal regulation is. And this is an update from my report to your committees from November of 2014. And the FAA was tasked with bringing unmanned aircraft systems into the national airspace by 2015. They're still working on the rulemaking for that. It's been put out earlier this year, and the expectation is the small unmanned aircraft system rule won't be in place until late 2016, if then. But they have put out now over 1,300 exceptions to the rule. And when I reported to you in November, there was only about 20, I think less than 20. So they've been very aggressive in issuing exceptions, what they call 333 exceptions, for commercial operations throughout the United States, and there are a number of them here in Oregon as well. And then they've also, we have three test ranges, as you recall, in Oregon, one at Pendleton, Warm Springs, and Tillamook, and those ranges now have authorization, blanket authorization, when they can get a certificate of authorization from the FAA to operate up to 400 feet. So before, it was not blanket like that, so they actually have made some changes there. And then they revised the one-page document from 1981 called AC, or Advisory Circular 9157. It's now a six- or seven-page document, and the main thrust of the change is that the FAA now has asserted their authority to enforce violations of safety against unmanned aircraft systems, including recreational, which were exempted by the 2012 FAA regulation. And then I was recently at a San Francisco conference where NASA and FAA are working on airspace for unmanned aircraft systems, and it was very surprising to me to see that Google and Amazon are both very heavily involved in identification and perhaps a traffic scheme for unmanned aircraft systems below 500 feet. And then of note, the governor of California just vetoed a bill that would have required no flights lower than 350 feet. And you recall that last session we did the 400-foot rescission and took that away. The governor of California vetoed one for 350 feet. So here's where we are from 2017 and the 2013 session and the key takeaways from that bill. And then we, as an agency, the Department of Aviation, will start registering unmanned aircraft systems beginning in January 2016 for public use only, public use drones only.
So with HB 2710 and then subsequently 837365, a public body may not operate a UAS that is capable of firing a bullet, projectile, or laser, which is, in essence, nobody should be able to weaponize a UAS. However, unfortunately, there might have been a slight oversight, and this doesn't apply to private users. Under ORS 837995, that provides penalties for using a weapon on a UAS, but model aircraft are specifically exempted in the definitions in 837300.
So this is how House Bill 2710 applies to individuals. It creates a crime of intentionally operating a drone to fire an aircraft, crash into an aircraft, or gain control. These are the areas that we want to be able to revise. And then, as you recall, we did revise the 400-foot altitude in the 2014 session. In the 15 session, removing the 400-foot altitude, and then you recall 2534. This is a dyslexic's nightmare. The two bills are very similarly numbered. You also passed the law that the Oregon Department of Fish and Wildlife develop rules prohibiting use of unmanned aircraft systems for hunting and angling, and also for harassing hunters and anglers. The work groups met several times. I mentioned the representation here, law enforcement, ACLU, the Criminal Defense Lawyers Association, and we've been under the watchful eye of State Representative Huffman here. He's been kind of giving us some guidance along the way.
Has that been difficult?
No, he's been very, very great to work with. So one of the things the Economic Development Subgroup was looking at is to make sure we continue to look at job creation in the U.S. industry. It's very possibly quite lucrative. And then we have the SOAR Board of Directors, which is promoting the test ranges and trying to bring economic development into the state. And as you recall, they got a grant from Oregon Inc. this past session to provide some revenue. So I think that's tracking well.
All right. So in the news, you hear about all the bad things about UAS, but I'm actually going to give you some good things that they actually do. In 2014, Peter Sox, a firefighter in Connecticut, actually used the UAS to determine whether firefighters could go into an area that had had some fire in it. It was a unique situation because it was a quarry that had a bunch of explosive material in it. So he was actually able to fly in, check it out, and make sure that the firefighters were able to go in. So that was one great use. On May 25th of this year, in the floodwaters in Joshua, Texas, Garrett Brill actually flew around the floodwaters and was able to find two people that they actually rescued. About a month ago, if you didn't know, in the fires over at the Paradise Fires in Washington State, Olympic National Park, there was an in-situ drone. In-situ is based out of White Salmon, but they flew around and were able to provide the Forest Service with updates on the perimeter of the fire. In Oregon specifically, destination marketing organizations like Travel Portland have used UAS to show how beautiful our state is. So they did a lot of videography and photography using that. And then Oregon State has been testing UAS to survey land and monitor forest health. And it even used a UAS to measure atmospheric temperatures, allowing for very, very precise measurements on a scale that has never been done.
Chair Przanski, Chair Barker, and members of the committee, I'm Kimberly McCullough with ACLU of Oregon. I've been primarily involved in this group in the privacy and law enforcement subgroup, and that group came together to address a number of issues, a pretty huge number of issues, actually, which is why our work is still in progress. One of those issues is that law enforcement frequently get calls from people who are concerned about drones. Maybe a drone's been flying over their property over and over again, and they don't know what to do about it. And they call law enforcement, and law enforcement sometimes knows what to tell them, and sometimes they don't. So that's part of the problem, is that we have some laws that may apply to these activities that people are doing, and law enforcement doesn't always know what those laws are or how to direct people. The other part of the problem, though, is that people can't necessarily identify who's flying the drone. And so that's a big issue that we don't necessarily know that we have the solution to. So it's just something that complicates things. Another issue is that law enforcement, they use drones, and in some instances, law enforcement were not aware of whether or not they could or couldn't do certain things that they wanted to do under the current statutory framework. Another big issue, obviously, is privacy, and drones can be used to invade someone's privacy, so we're looking at that. Also, public safety issues. And then also, there are commercial drone operators who would really love to fly drones in Oregon. They would like to do that to, say, for example, deliver packages to your door or do some other things. And they cannot do that currently under our current statutory framework, which says that you can't fly a drone over someone's private property. If they've told you that they don't want to, they can then sue you if you do it again. And so there has been some desire on the part of those commercial operators to remove that restriction, basically to say that if the FAA tells them they can fly somewhere, that the state of Oregon shouldn't tell them that they can't. So the work group came together to, first of all, to review our current statutes and see how they apply to all of these different situations, to see if those statutes need some changes or if it's just a matter of educating folks about what the statutes already say, or if there's potentially some non-legislative ways that we can address some of these issues. So one of the big things that we came up with that's in development, and Mitch is working on this with some folks from law enforcement, is a FAQ to put up online that would be for the public and for law enforcement, so that the law enforcement will know what they can and can't do, and also so that they know how to respond to people and what to tell them about, you know, these are the potential laws that this person is violating and so on. Another thing that we kept coming back to is, because of that issue of not being able to identify the drones, is that possibly one of the things that could maybe help with that is registration or requiring registration, and that would also trigger some sort of educational requirement for people who fly drones so that they know what they can and can't do. All right, we'll go to the next slide.
Kenji. Sure. Some of the large potential changes that we're looking for or bringing up is that HB 2710 applies to all UAS, not just, well, including hobbyist drones, which have been exempted. Specifically, ORS 837375, interfering with UAS or getting unauthorized control over UAS, that doesn't apply to hobbyist or commercial drones. And then also ORS 837995, crimes involving UAS, and as we described earlier, that had to deal with weaponizing drones. We also want to make sure that all aircraft less than 55 pounds used for recreational purposes fall within the restrictions of HB 2710.
All right, so some of the potential changes that we're fairly close to, but we haven't reached a complete consensus on, are on this page. So one of those is that ORS 164885, endangering an aircraft, that statute was designed to prohibit the harm of endangering an aircraft that has people on it. That's a really serious thing, so that's why it has a very serious offense, and it's a felony, a Class C felony. That's not really the same harm as endangering a drone that doesn't have people on it, so we want to just make clear, or we're thinking about making clear, that that doesn't apply to unmanned aircraft. Another statute that we looked at is invasion of privacy. So with invasion of privacy, it's a defense to invasion of privacy if you're in a public place. Public place includes highways, and technically the airways are highways. ways. And so we're concerned that someone could invade someone's privacy using a drone, but then use the defense that, oh, well, I was flying in the air and so therefore it was okay. So think about it like this. If a person is in a public place or usually on a sidewalk or somewhere else, you know, if they can see something from that vantage point, it makes sense to have that be a defense to an invasion of privacy because you can see it from the sidewalk. If you can take a drone and you can fly it up in the air somewhere that a person never could go and then see something and use that as a defense, oh, well, I was in a highway, that's kind of a different situation. And so we're potentially looking at some change that would make it clear that that's not a defense. Another situation or another statute that we looked at is interference with a firefighter or emergency medical service provider. There's some concerns that people flying drones will get too close, like to firefighters, and cause some problems. So we've been talking about the possibility of something that would create just sort of a set perimeter around around firefighters and emergency medical services so that people know how close they can and can't get with a drone. You know, there is some potential First Amendment issues there with news gathering and such, so it would need to be something that was tailored so that it was clear that it was for public safety and sort of the minimal amount for public safety. Another situation that we looked at is similar to, so we have a private right of action if somebody flies their drone over your property over and over again and you don't want them to, but we don't have any sort of criminal penalty, nothing that the police can do. So we looked at criminal mischief 3 as potentially being the closest, something that's like sort of the closest to using a drone as a nuisance or something to harass. But we were thinking that rather than creating a criminal penalty like a misdemeanor or felony, that this would be something that's more along the lines of a violation. So you essentially get a ticket if you use your drone to harass someone. So that's also a possibility. The group was pretty across the board wanted that to be a violation rather than a criminal, like something that would leave you with a criminal record.
So under House Bill 2710, the requirement is for me to begin registering the public use drones and also to make a recommendation to you on whether we should register commercial and the recreational drones. The commercial and the public use are going to be required to have N numbers by the FAA. The recreational, there is no such requirement. They can be very small. So there's a real challenge in trying to decide how we could go about that process. So we tossed it around. You've heard the analogy that I used is like chasing individual bees instead of going to the beehive, which an airport is. So we thought maybe registering the operator might be a better way, and we're not firmly committed to this at all. But the methodology would be they have to go online, take a test, show their knowledge, and pay a small fee that covers the cost of administrating the program. That this is just an option that we're looking at. And then they also get some sort of a sticker or marker to put on their airframe, so if they do lose it or if they do overfly somebody's private property, you at least have a means of establishing accountability and identity of who owns that particular unmanned aircraft system. The bottom line, we'd like to make it as simple and easy and inexpensive as we possibly can.
Oh, and as a quick follow-up, as Director Swecker said, they can be small. They can be this small, or they can even be smaller. There's ones that are about an inch by an inch in size, too. So those are considerations.
Mm-hmm, absolutely. So there's a few things that we've wanted to look at as a group, but that we haven't been able to get to yet. And so I'm just gonna go through those fairly quickly. There was a law that was passed in Nevada recently that prohibits the operation of a UAS within 500 horizontal feet or 250 vertical feet of a critical facility. So that's jails, correctional facilities, refineries, and so on. So there's, you know, some discussion of whether or not we want to do something similar to that in Oregon. We've heard about folks, for example, flying over a prison and then dropping things into the yard. So the bill in that was passed in Nevada was a misdemeanor, and we're not entirely sure if this is something that we want to do. There are already some laws that do restrict these activities. I mean, it's already a crime to bring something into a correctional facility. So it may be that it's not that we need a new law. It may be that we need some different approach. Maybe there's something technologically that can be done or physically that can be done. But this is just something that we've started to talk about. A few other, we can go to the next slide. A few other issues that we've been talking about is data collection. So we do know that there are some public agencies like ODOT that use drones, and they use them to collect some information. So it could be that we want to look at that information that they're gathering and what the requirements for that are and how they share that information and so on. Same thing with commercial operators and their collection of information and or private citizens. One thing that we do know is that agencies don't necessarily have policies around their data collection using drones, and so it may be that we want to look at something like the policies that we've required for body cams and try to come up with something similar, just sort of a baseline of this is what the agency needs to have in place as privacy protections. Another thing that we obviously have been, I brought up earlier, alluded to, and I think this is something that we really want your input on and would love to sort of see what direction you want us to go in, is these commercial users who want to use drones in Oregon and potentially fly over private property or possibly fly on routes that aren't over private property. I mean, one option would be that they have lanes that they can fly in that are designated lanes. Another would be that there'd be limitations on whether or not they can hover over your property, or maybe there'd be some trespass or noise violations or, you know, requirements that way. So we really want to know what you guys think about that. There definitely is a lot of desire in industry to be able to fly drones around Oregon. So yeah, we want to know what you have to say about that. And then another possibility that we've just started to talk about. Elsie gave us a suggestion that we might want to actually define aircraft in the criminal code. It's an undefined term, and so it's not clear whether or not it includes unmanned aircraft in addition to manned aircraft, and so it would be good to just have a definition so that that runs throughout the statutes, and then if there's an exception to that, then you can clarify that there's an exception, but it's currently undefined. So yeah. I think that actually brings us... Yeah.
To the closure.
Questions and feedback if you have them.
I will say that the FAA defines aircraft very, very liberally. It's a device that is used or intended to be used for flight in the air, period. That's it. So it covers unmanned and manned aircraft under the FAA's definition. I also provided you with a copy of a document, a flyer, that is a compilation from the AUVSI, which is unmanned aircraft systems incorporate international, and the AMA, which is the Association for Model Aeronautics, and the FAA, and it defines what a commercial aircraft is, it defines what a public use one is, it defines what a recreational one is, and gives you the limitations on how they can be used in current federal law. And subject to any questions, that concludes our presentation.
Any questions? Sorry, Senator Prozanski.
Thank you. Mitch, regarding your identification for the unmanned aircraft, you're talking about potentially doing the individual and then maybe having some type of identification and he showed us how small they can be. So I'm trying to figure out, one, how would we accomplish that to actually have something large enough to be identified from some distance? And did the group look at using the marine model as to how they license or permit boats and with OR and then a number type of system instead of just limiting it to registering the individual?
And Chair Prozanski, it's a real challenge, I think, to find a sticker that's universal in size enough that you could see it from a distance, especially when you're talking about something that small. Right. By registering the owner, you at least establish, and this is recreational only, not for commercial or public use, but you could at least establish some accountability. And we might be able to find something that's small enough to go on that and then have a larger size up to 55 pounds for an aircraft. It's going to be a challenge to get that right, if we're going to do all that process online.
Mm-hmm. Sure.
Yes, Representative Green. Thank you.
Can a person shoot down a drone that's hovering over his property?
Shot.
Yeah. Chair Przanski, Barker, Representative Greenlich. No, that would be a violation of federal law and also of the bill passed here 2710.
Be a violation of state law as well as federal
yes.
law.
Mm-hmm.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Representative Springer.
Thank you, Mr. Co-Chair. You brought up a great point that I want to talk about a little bit that has recently come to light from some of my forest folks, given this last wildfire season, which was horrendous and awful. And I had a call, called some of my forest owners and Department of Forestry folks, and I said, what can I do? Short of picking up a shovel, what can I do? Universally, their biggest number one complaint was air suppression aircraft or fire suppression aircraft were not able to make drops because there were already drones in the area. And if you know anything about wildfires, there are oftentimes small windows of opportunity to make those. And so I pushed them a little harder because I know that they were in the, no pun intended, the heat of battle, things were intense. They were not in good moods. And I said, can you guarantee me there have been flights suspended because of drones? And they said, absolutely. This fire season. And so when I looked at ORS 16257 that you had up there, and then I look at your document here where these are safety guidelines. It looks like some of them reflect laws and some of them reflect common sense, frankly. It says here, remain well clear of and do not interfere with manned aircraft operations. You must see and avoid other aircraft and obstacles at the time. It's quite easy during a wildfire because there were some really cool pictures of forest fires on Facebook, which I'd venture to say were taken by drones, quite frankly. So they're up there and there's no aircraft, no fire suppression aircraft around at the time. So they're not in violation right there, but you have manned aircraft who can't take off because of that. How can we fix that? Because I much prefer to have a fire put out than a cool picture of the fire.
Springer. The FAA has fairly strong regulations on that and the ability to fine. Normally, around a fire like that, where they put out what's called a TFR, a temporary flight restriction, which is very publicly announced, and you're not allowed to operate that. There's a big education program going on right now, and there is actually a beta test of a application you can put on your phone to advise you when and where you can and cannot fly. In the current law, federal law, if the FAA knows about an incident like that, and they're getting very aggressive about that, they can fine a operator of an unmanned aircraft system that interferes with firefighting efforts like that fairly large amounts in the $10,000 ranges. So there is an effort at the federal level, and what we looked at here was, is there anything at the state level? And that's what we found. So it really is up to the legislature to decide if that's strong enough. Or what you'd like to see other than that.
Follow-up, Mr. Chair? Follow-up. But then we go back to, can you track who that drone belongs to?
Here I am.
Okay.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, thank you. Representative Post.
Thank you. Mr. Chair, I appreciate that. Thank you guys for this presentation. I was actually really looking forward to it all day today, and I'm fascinated by this stuff. And Kimberly, maybe more for you because you were talking when that one slide was up, and I didn't think it would come up, but it did. Not that I really want to revisit the debacle at Autzen Stadium last Saturday, but I have to. Football fans will understand that. I was at Autzen Stadium. You had a picture of the stadium. I was at Autzen tailgating, and a drone flew right over us and hovered and stopped, and I assume it was taking pictures, probably, of every single group of tailgaters and then went back into the stadium and then came back. It did it like, I don't know, 8 to 10 times, enough that everybody was aware of it. And I've been there for 19 years going to games. I've never seen that before. It kind of freaked people out. So I wonder where that falls under, since you had a picture of a stadium and you touched on it just a minute. I felt a little invasion of privacy, although I assumed it was probably the Ducks taking pictures and, oh boy, look at all the tailgaters. But what do you think about something like that?
Yeah, I mean, I think that, or Chair Barker, Chair Przanski, and Representative Post, I think that's a really challenging question to answer. And I'm not sure that I know exactly what the solution is, but if you're looking at, you know, places like stadiums, sure, somebody could be walking around and just taking pictures of everybody. I mean, and so there's sort of First Amendment issues involved. There's also this strong discomfort, and I think that's part of what's been motivating, in large part, the desire to not have drones flying over our private property. So they may see things in our backyard they wouldn't have been able to see otherwise. So I don't know exactly where we draw the line, but I think that we really do have to keep the First Amendment in mind, particularly in those sort of public spaces, like at a stadium or at a political event or whatever. Those are kinds of spaces where we're very observable and we're in public and people legally can take photographs. So we don't necessarily want to restrict them from doing what they could already do and what's protected. So, but I do understand that, and I think that's a super huge challenge that we all have to face with this, is that, do we want to live in a world where there's drones flying everywhere taking pictures of everybody at all times? And that may be the world that we're headed towards whether we like it or not.
Yeah. Okay, thanks.
Kenji?
Kenji.
Chairs and Representative Post. Actually, there are some special security instructions that restricts flights over stadiums during Major League Baseball games, National Football League games, regular season NCAA football, and motor speedway events, and that's for the FAA. So that person who was flying that drone was likely in violation of FAA.
Okay, well, let me make sure I'm clear. It was pregame.
It was pregame. Mm-hmm.
So it flew into the stadium. Mm-hmm. 2 hours before the game and came back out, back and forth. But once the game started, I think it was, I don't remember seeing it again.
Okay, because it starts, it says it's 1 hour before the event, scheduled event time and 1 hour after the event.
Okay, but that is good to know.
Yeah. That is good to know. Thank you. Kenji, I think you offered to actually do a demonstration for us.
No.
And we can't do it here in the room.
Why not?
Well, because
there's
people around here that aren't us that says it can't be done.
Oh, okay.
Chair Przanski.
Or it should not be done.
Yes. This is writing.
So I'm wondering if you would be able to, if someone wanted to go out and see a demonstration, if you would be able to do that. Maybe today, or we could schedule that for some time in the future.
Chair Przanski, I'd love to do a demo for everybody, and we can schedule that for another day.
Okay.
Any further questions? Thank you very much for your interesting testimony today. Next item on the agenda is an update on the status of untested sexual assault forensic evidence kits. Michelle Roland Schwartz and Superintendent Evans.
We're going to do this, please.
Yeah, okay, and also funding needs for a comprehensive school safety hotline.
Thank you.
You don't have any around.
We're doing this for a moment.
Yeah.
Shoot it down. He's just going to get shot.
Any order, but please remember to identify yourself for the record.
Yes. Chair Barker, Chair Przanski, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Richard Evans, and I'm the superintendent of the Oregon State Police. We're here to talk about the safe kits and the school safety task force. We'll start with the update on the sexual assault forensic evidence kits. For those that aren't familiar with it, back in the 2015 legislature, Senate Bill 563 was introduced, which required the counting or the collecting of sexual assault forensics evidence kits that were in the possession of Oregon law enforcement. And so we met with legislators and formed a work group to work on this issue without requiring legislative action. The work group consisted of the Sheriff's Association, Chiefs Association, myself, and victim advocates. Michelle is seated to my right as one of the victim advocates. One of the things we wanted to work on and come up with is best practices. Obviously, the concern was the number or the amount of sexual assault forensics evidence kits in police custody that had not been tested. The Oregon State Police did the inventory across the state with the help of our partner law enforcement agencies. We found that there are 5,652 kits that have not been tested in police custody or police inventory, and they dated back to 1983. One of the things to remember with the sexual assault forensics evidence kit, the prior police practice was if you had an identified suspect, so if a rape was reported to me as a detective and the victim told me that Joe Smith was a suspect, I would interview Joe Smith. He said, yes, we had sex or sexual contact. The kit wasn't sent in because the issue really became consent, not the issue of whether the sexual contact occurred. And that was the current or basically an unwritten practice across the state of Oregon. Another thing that we looked at is looking at how many kits were prior, if you enacted the statute of limitations, how many kits in law enforcement custody today would be beyond the current 12-year statute of limitations. I know that there are members of the committee that were interested in this as we had this further discussion about extending the statute of limitations. So I took the January 1st date, and there are 1,100 cases where 1,100 of those safe kits are past the current statute of limitations of 12 years. And so that is what we have for the safe kits. I also want to let the committee know that that doesn't represent all of the reported rapes. If a victim came to the Oregon State Police 3 weeks after the suspected sexual assault and reported that, a safe kit wouldn't be generated because there'd be no evidence of that. So what I don't know is how many other cases are out there that were not reported to law enforcement or reported to law enforcement after the statute of limitations and before it was changed in this last session. So the number that we have of 1,100 could be a lot larger if we looked into that number deeper, and I want to make sure we had clarity on that. So what we did is we broke into two groups, law enforcement, and try to solve this issue. I know that in the Portland area, this issue was extremely controversial for the Portland Police Bureau, and I want to give a shout out to Chief O'Day and his staff because they were with me from day one on this issue, and we worked extremely hard trying to get this resolved. And Chief O'Day has been instrumental in working through this. So we broke it into two groups. One is the law enforcement group, and how do we solve this problem for Oregon? Because the perception is, whether we like it or not, that if the kit isn't tested, law enforcement wasn't doing their job protecting victims. And the fact of the matter is that's unacceptable for us. We also broke it into the victim's side of the conversation. I'll let Michelle talk about this. So this is the best practices that we're going to recommend starting January 1st of this year. One of my biggest concerns is that if we didn't do something with the drop dead date, the backlog would continue to grow and we still have this problem going forward. And I didn't want that to continue. So the remedy we came up with is effective January 1st, 2016, we create a date. Everything in 2015 and back is we will consider the backlog and work on that. Anything from January 1st, 2016 and forward, we were requesting that the chiefs and sheriffs submit all non-anonymous kits to us within 14 days for testing at the crime lab. That's a significant change in our practice, and we believe that if we do that, we will start the public safety value of doing that is we will start being able to associate serial rapists that go from one community to another and other suspects that join cases together that really at this point haven't been done. The other thing is that we had an issue, and public issue is that when an anonymous kit comes in, the victim does not want to do anything with that. Oregon law allows a victim to come in and say, I have a safe kit, I have this safe kit, but I'm not sure I want to be a victim yet. That we call those anonymous kits, and we don't test those without the victim's consent. But one of the things that we found is that the practice of keeping those kits is varied across law enforcement in Oregon. In fact, some of them were destroyed after 6 months. We know victims often take different amounts of time to come cope with the issue and come forward. So the best practice that we believe is in the best interest of public safety is we will keep those kits for the current statute of limitations for 12 years so that victim can come forward at any time during that statute of limitations and request the kit to be tested or come forward with prosecution in their case. So that's the best practices for law enforcement. I met with the Chiefs and Sheriff's Association today. We rolled this out. There's one additional thing that we're going to do when from January 1st, 2016 going forward. We will, when a law enforcement agency submits evidence to the crime lab, they fill out a specific form. We are going to create a specific form for the safe kit so that we can also keep track of some trends, victim identification, things that the lab hasn't tracked before, and also so that we're able to triage cases as they come in. If we get an unknown suspect where force was used on a juvenile female suspect, that's going to go right to the top of the list compared to a case that comes in where it's a known offender, known suspect. We're going to be able to triage the cases that come into the crime lab based upon public safety needs. So that's what we're doing is the law enforcement side. We're also concerned of notification as we test these kits and we go forward one more. One of the things that we're doing is the Portland Police Bureau and the five largest counties got grants through the federal government to help us assist in testing of the backlog. One of the grants is for 2 years, one of the grants is 3 years. We're also having to repurpose some of our DNA analysts within the crime lab to tackle this problem. We have DNA analysts that are currently working on property crimes and other requests from our public safety partners. We're going to have to look at this because I don't know how many kits are going to come in at the beginning of this because we've never had this practice before. So I expect that I will report back to you on the increased workload, if there is any, and how we're doing on working on the backlog using the two additional legislatively approved scientists that we got in 2016, the backlog with using outside sources and the grants, and working on the backlog separately of what is currently happening from January 1st, 2016 and forward. So that is really
December 1st, right?
December 1st, I'm sorry, sir. That's the hire date.
December 1st, 16?
Yes, sir. They were phased, co-chairs, Brzezinski, co-chair Barker, they were phased into our budget process from 2015. They were added in 6 months increments, and we're going to be hiring those folks in the near future, if that makes sense.
Representative Springer?
Are these folks wrapped up? Do you want me to hold my question?
No, they're still.
They're still going.
Representative Greenwich, did you have a follow-up?
Let
me just get this cleared.
Okay. I just wanted to make sure that it wasn't January 1st, 16th and June 1st, 16th. That would be 6 month increments. So the first one won't be hired until the middle of
December.
Yes. Sorry.
December of 16 or 15, excuse me. That's correct.
That's 15.
That's the time. You got it right.
Okay. Now I got it.
We had a grammatical error earlier. We have a typo now, sir. So, continue the next one.
Yeah, absolutely.
The challenge for us in the crime lab, as you know, and I've reported this to committee before, is that we continue to have backlogs in all of our scientific data. It takes a year to train a DNA scientist from the day we hire them before they're allowed to work by themselves. And when they're being trained in that year process, the scientist that's training them cannot dedicate themselves to the entire casework. So we actually, by hiring folks, often create backlogs. And there, you know, when you talk about grants and using people, the grants usually run out by the time you can hire a scientist, train them, and then obviously the people that are qualified to do that don't want to be on a grant. They can go to other labs and do that type of work. So it's a challenge for us. And we've seen the increase in DNA, but we've seen increases in all of our specific disciplines in the crime lab in the last few years, toxicology, trace evidence, and some of the other ones. So I'm through with my section, and I will turn it over to Michelle on the victim side.
Okay, fantastic.
Good afternoon, Chair Barker, Chair Przanski, members of the committee. My name is Michelle Roland-Schwartz. I'm Executive Director of the Oregon Attorney General Sexual Assault Task Force. We are a statewide nonprofit, non-governmental organization whose mission is to facilitate a multidisciplinary approach to survivor-centered practices in responding to victims of sexual assault across Oregon. Oregon State Police and our statewide Safe Kit Work Group asked the task force to lead an effort to develop recommendations on victim notification moving forward with untested kits. And in addition to pulling from our membership and on our task force and other statewide partners, we've received significant levels of training and technical assistance from the Joyful Heart Foundation, which is a national organization that is dedicated to addressing this issue. We pulled together partners not only from the fields of advocacy, but also law enforcement and prosecution to develop the recommendations and had our first work group meeting last week in which we essentially came to the agreement that we recognize and understand that there has been a significant lapse since victims originally had a safe kit done, and that contacting them several years later is going to bring up old issues for them that they may not be prepared for in the moment. So an example is a victim that we heard her story that she had lost her mother. Her mother had passed away the same week that she was notified that there was some kind of development in her kit. And so you can imagine the impact that it had on that victim in that moment. And so recognizing that there are events that are happening in people's lives 5-10 years out that we need to be aware of when we notify victims of these particular cases. So national experiences indicate what we might experience here, that some victims may be pleased to learn that additional evidence has been obtained, and others may view the news as traumatic or unwelcome. And so our goal in our recommendations is to implement policies in Oregon that are victim-centered and mitigate trauma. So when the work group met last week, our discussion centered around three core questions. Who does the notification? When does the notification happen? And how are victims notified? So promising practices indicate that pairing a criminal justice provider, so someone from the district attorney's office or a law enforcement officer, with a victim advocate provides the best wraparound support in conducting that victim notification. And so that will be included in our recommendations and will be implemented depending on the jurisdiction and the capacity of victim advocacy programs, whether that will be a victim assistance program advocate out of a district attorney's office or community-based nonprofit advocate. Secondly, we had a discussion about when victims should be notified about the status of their kit. And unanimously, everyone agreed that we should be notifying victims on the outcome of their kits, regardless of whether or not there's been evidence obtained. And so all victims deserve to know whether or not anything has happened in terms of a CODIS hit or some kind of evidentiary development in their particular case. That also includes cases where the statute of limitations has passed. And so notifying victims in a manner that recognizes that for them, even if the case cannot be prosecuted, there are other forms of justice for that victim and other ways in which that they could engage. And so our recommendations will include that practice as well. And then last, the means of notification. Looking nationally at some of the practices and what we have learned from other cities, whether the means is by phone, in person, letter, or email. And I think it's obvious that there are layers of confidentiality in each of those manners of, or means of communication that we need to consider. And so our recommendations will include phone contact be the primary source, but we also recognize that that there may be a challenge with that. And so what are the circumstances in which we would contact a victim doing in-person notification? And what are the situations in which in-person contact we need to think about that process. An example is a detective in another city that has dealt with this issue arrived at a home and noticed balloons hanging around the house and very quickly realized that the family was getting ready to celebrate their child's birthday, and that moment was not the moment to go knocking on the door. Another example is knocking on the door of a victim and she requesting that they leave and not come back because her now middle school age child was inside and was the result of the sexual assault and did not know. And so keeping those kinds of things in mind as we move forward with notification is really important, and it very much matters. Our goal is to have our recommendations formed by mid-November as we move into rolling out these recommendations across the state, so that the recommendations reflect our goals to protect the autonomy and dignity of survivors. And as you can imagine, with several thousand untested kits in Oregon, our recommendations will have an impact on service providers, especially advocates whose resources are already stretched thin. So imagine I can forecast some conversations about what kind of resources we need to have put in place for advocacy organizations that will undoubtedly be part of this process. Thank you so much for the opportunity to give you an update, and if you have any further questions, I'm happy to answer those for you today.
And I just wanted to clarify one thing. So if there's DNA evidence on these first degree sex crimes, there is the statute of limitation is waived. On the second degree sex crimes, there's 25 years. And then once the once law enforcement knows who the suspect is, they have 2 years to commence the action. So
yes, sir.
But so that, yeah, because I've got a little confused. It was sounding like we're worried about the 12-year thing, and that doesn't apply when we have the DNA.
Chair right. Barker, Chair Persansky, members of the committee, we're going to test every kit, and each specific, you know, they're obviously going to have different fact right. sets. But yeah, we're not worried about that. We were trying to come up with a more standard approach for law enforcement to try to remedy the issue right away. That's basically how we came with the 12 years.
And also, you mentioned Chief O'Day. He's come under a lot of criticism, and so he's the one that failed to do this. Back when this was going on, when now Deputy Chief in Salem, Jim Ferraris, tried to get things changed, he was in charge of the detective division. He wasn't in charge of the bureau, and you have to have a little more horsepower than he did to make that change. But Chief O'Day was a sergeant working for me on the street in Southeast Portland at the time, so he was pretty far removed, and now the mountain's caving in on his head a little unfairly, in my opinion.
The one thing, Chair Persansky, Chair Barker for the committee, is that Portland Police Bureau has been at the forefront of working with this issue with us and the group, and I wanted the members of the committee to know that, because I don't think that's been portrayed accurately. They've been a driving force in some of my conversations, and they've been very good partners in trying to establish this, including and securing grants for additional testing, things like that. They've been right there with us, and I wanted that on the record.
Thank you. Appreciate that. Representative Springer, did you have?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Maybe a couple questions,
okay.
With your indulgence,
please.
So is the state police the only crime lab in the state of Oregon that is used, publicly funded crime lab? Individual agencies, regardless of their size, don't have their own crime labs.
Chair Barker, Chair Persansky, I believe that the Portland Police Bureau has some limited capabilities of a crime lab, and I believe Eugene PD has some limited capacity as a crime lab. They do different disciplines. I'm not sure what those are, but they do have those. I'm not sure if it's DNA, but they do have some.
Yeah, I don't think so.
Some capability.
Follow up. Do they test the safe kits, or do all the safe kits go to OSP?
Chair Barker, Chair Persansky, I believe that we test all the safe kits, but I can check and verify and forward that information to the committee.
That's right. Yeah.
Follow up, please. So on one of the slides, it said that agencies will be required, if I understood it correctly,
correct.
Required to send a safe kit to the crime lab, OSP crime lab, within 14 days.
Yes.
What I didn't see, and perhaps I missed it, what is the requirement then on OSP to process that kit?
Chair Barker, Chair Przanski, Representative Springer, I wish I could answer that question, but I don't know how many kits we're going to get in at the time, and it's going to be a capacity issue for us. We only have so many DNA scientists, and like I said, the two that were allotted to us to the legislature are for the backlog. We have a turnaround time that we try to maintain of 90 days on the sexual assault kits, and I can actually forward the members of the committee a report on how we're doing on the one, on the kits that we have received as of to date and how well we're keeping up with that backlog. I can provide you with that information or that those requests.
Thank you. Follow up. Thank you.
Let me just follow up on what the superintendent said. I also took notes that he said that public safety needs would be considered and there will be a triage. So the kits that are coming in within those 14 days, there will be some type of review and determination as to the facts on that case, if they are ones that are aggravated, minors, whatever that list will be, they're going to be up to the top of the list for checking. So that's how they're going to triage out. And so the ones that seem to have a higher public safety need will be addressed first off. That's what I took away.
Chair Barker, Chair Przanski, absolutely correct. We want to make sure that the ones with the highest public safety value at the time come and get tested first. That doesn't mean we won't get to the other ones, but we will absolutely have a way of triaging the kits that come in after January 1st, moving the ones to the top of the list that have the greatest public safety value.
Follow up. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Co-chair. This has been a pretty big deal in the public eye and in the press, and a couple things that I'd like us to remain aware of or be aware of as we have this conversation is I really see this as a two-prong issue. One is you have evidence, safe kits, whatever it would be, you have evidence at the agency with jurisdiction. And then you have processing that evidence with OSP. And when we look at kits or any kind of evidence that hasn't been processed, I remember being a cop collecting any evidence I possibly could, whether I knew how it was going to be used at the time. But if it was legal for me to collect evidence, because developments may come beyond the first 20 minutes of an investigation, to have that evidence. Sometimes there was never any use for that evidence. It really just, nothing came, there was no use of that evidence, or more facts to the case became evident, and we have a different situation than we initially had or believed that we had. So I want to be careful as we talk about this, that just because something is sitting there, it may or may not have value yet or ever. So when I hear agencies will be required to send, and safe kits are definitely a different piece, a very important piece. When I hear agencies are going to be required to send evidence in 14 days, what I don't want to occur, and I can remember years back the backlog at OSP in the crime lab because there's one, what I don't want to see is this evidence that's forced to go to OSP creating a bottleneck when there's real evidence that's very timely being processed. And I hope that we're not confusing these two arms of the issue. We just want everything cleaned up. I want the right stuff cleaned up. I want the right stuff dealt with, not just an automatic, you got to move it over here. So talk to me a little bit about that and help me with that concern.
Chair Barker, Chair Przanski, Representative Springer, the first two or three discussions that we had in the task force was just about that. How do we prioritize the work? How do we make sure that the public safety issue is number one? And so that's the reason we created the new form, to make sure that we are prioritizing that. We will also have DNA evidence coming in on homicides, armed invasion, and we're going to be doing that work also. The key to this is making sure that we track what is coming in the door and how we're keeping up with it, and then reporting back to the legislature to make sure that we have the resources. As I've said before, my biggest problem is getting a DNA scientist trained and up and running and working, and we recognize that we're going to have to prioritize our work. But I do believe that there's a strong public safety value from, if you look at what has happened in the testing of the safe kits back east, they have been able to put together serial rapists that befriend women, they're their friend, then they move to another town, they do it again. They're linking these crimes, and these crimes are serious crimes, so we're going to take them seriously, but we will prioritize this evidence with all other DNA evidence as we move forward. I will tell you that it's going to be a challenge for us in January, and before too long we'll know exactly where the push points are going to be, and I'm hoping to come back and talk to you folks about those issues as they come forward. We're not discounting any other evidence. The public perception of this has not pushed it to where we're only going to do this and something else. I just believe that this is the best practice, that we're moving forward with public safety, and we'll weigh every other issue that comes through the door at the same time, if that answers your question.
Thank you.
Representative Leininger.
Thank you for the really helpful presentation and for your work helping us deal with a problem that we've all recognized. I want to confirm what I think I heard you say in the exchange with Chair Barker. Is it right that all safe kits are going to be tested, be they 12 years old or older?
So Chair Przanski, Representative Leininger, all the non-anonymous kits. Anonymous kits will not be tested, period. And that's been extremely important to our victim groups. So we will triage those, the backlog, as we go. So we're going to triage the new kits that come in, and we will also triage the backlog that comes in and see which ones rise to the level and report back to the legislature on how many we've got to, what is left. I have personally looked at the OSB cases of the 66. Five of those people are in prison serving long sentences. So when OSP sends those in, those will be pushed to the bottom of the list and may not be tested. It depends on where we get to, because that person's DNA is already on file because of the convicted felon status. So there's some of that to be play out as we move forward.
Thank you. That's helpful. So automatically, you'll test all the non-anonymous kits back to the point, you know, that you have in the backlog. Is there a perception in the victim community or you know, within this work group, that since it does take many years sometimes for victims to decide to identify as victims and perhaps to go from anonymous status to choosing to go to identified victim status, that we might revisit their interest in that if a lot of time has lapsed? Maybe they feel differently than they did when they first were tested.
So Chair Barker, Chair Przanski, Representative Leininger, the number one, I looked at the 66 cases, and the number one issue in OSP that we found is they had the safe kit done, and then when the detective wanted to follow up in the investigation, the victim did not want to participate any longer. And that was the number one reason that the safe kits weren't tested and the investigation went no farther. And so we've had discussions in our work group on how we're going to deal with that as we go forward, because everybody's different. You have the folks that don't want anything in the beginning, then they want it at the end, then folks that want it in the beginning and don't want anything to do with the law enforcement in the end, and that's a really delicate conversation that I'm glad I have Michelle to help me through that, because it is very difficult. You don't want to traumatize a victim more than, you know, in the attempt to try to get all this done, we have to be really cognizant of the impact of what we're doing, and that has been discussed, and we haven't come up with how we're going to deal with that yet.
A follow-up. Rich and Michelle, I think one of the things that might be worth looking at for best practices for those coming cases going forward, now that we're setting this up, that the time that a rape kit is taken and the investigation's ongoing, meaning and time of the offense, that maybe it would be appropriate to have something to be giving to that individual to have an understanding that kit, if it's coming in as anonymous, it will be kept for the 12 years of the statute of limitations, giving them the protocol and procedure of how they can
activate it, because one of the things I'm concerned with is that if we reach out, let's say at 10 years and say, oh, by the way, you only have two more years, we are now interfering potentially with someone who's decided not to do anything. So it seems to me on the front end, we should be able to give that and should give that information so they understand what their rights are and how they can activate it. The other thing, and this is really, Michelle, looking at the stuff that she went through, the who, I had who, how, which is the means, and when notification occurs. Did I understand, I'm not sure if I fully appreciate it, you said it, potentially having someone with law enforcement and then a victim advocate. Could you just walk through that part? Because there was another thing at the very end, you said means of notification, talking about potentially doing something by mail or by phone call. And so I just want to see and make sure the record's correct as to what we are looking at doing.
Sure. Chair Posonski, that's a great question. Again, kind of going back to, we've had several conversations with Joyful Heart Foundation around this and are waiting for a report that they're getting ready to publish around these specific issues. And so, looking at the four means of communication, our primary goal is to have phone communication as the first line, and that communication would happen with a criminal justice provider, whether that be the prosecutor or law enforcement officer, in combination with a victim advocate. And the victim advocate may be, depending on the jurisdiction, because of capacity and resources, it might be a victim assistance advocate, it might be a community-based advocate. But giving victims the opportunity to, one, hear that there's been some development in their case, and then getting information from the victim advocate about what resources they have available. It also ensures that we have some way of having a consistent message across the board about how that information is shared with victims. So, for example, a simple apology starting off, and then what are some of the other resources that are available. If it's a victim assistance advocate, one of the conversations that we had is building in some kind of assurance that victims are being connected with their local crisis center. So if there's difficulty in reaching a victim by phone, there are considerations that we would need to make in terms of doing in-person contact. Okay. If that's not available, then sending a letter out, and we're actually working on a sample letter so that it's as confidential as possible. If a family member happened to open the letter, they're not going to see detailed information about what the letter is in regards to. So there are a lot of considerations to make, and that's something that we're working on.
I would also suggest, based on the other example you gave us, that if it goes to the point of needing to notify by mail, that it's done by certified restricted delivery. So that only that individual would have the right to get that notification that doesn't fall in the wrong person's hands.
Thank you.
Representative Greenlight.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Superintendent Evans, I'm sort of amazed by what you said about a new technician who I assume comes trained before you hire them, ends up spending a year with a supervisor who, so the two together get no more than any one does. There have been extraordinary changes in DNA technology. Is our technology outdated? Is there technology available in the future, in the near future, that could make this simpler and faster and less expensive? Because I know commercially, you can get DNA tests off for $200 and get them back in a week.
Chair Barker, Chair Krasinski, that you can get a test done. We could, if you gave us evidence today, we can process that evidence in 6 to 12 hours, depending on what it is. It's the having the employees to be able to do that. There are different confirmation. So as I understand it with DNA, there are certain ways of doing it. And when you're working on a sexual assault task force, there are more. When you're working on that type of a crime, there are more hurdles to jump through than just a confirmatory test on DNA for whether or not you're my dad or not. It's more detailed work. And so I'm not a scientist, but I talked to him a little bit because I have the same concern. You know, you can do this quicker, but saying you're related to somebody is a lot different than identifying you as the exact person that is in this sample, from how I understand it. So it's a lot more. If I'm going to say you're the person that this DNA belongs to in a sexual assault kit, that's different than me just saying that you are related to Representative Olson. It's a much deeper comparison.
Wait a minute, I am not related.
That's not what the DNA says.
Give me 12 hours.
Yeah. May I follow up?
Sure, please.
Let's go simply to the technology question. Is there advances in technology available that could speed up the process, or are we pretty much at the state of the art? That's the question I'm asking.
Chair Barker, Chair Przanski, from what I understand, it continues to evolve, the DNA science, but I can't personally answer that question. I will definitely have somebody from my staff notify the committee on if there are some advances that haven't been rolled out to the labs yet. I can't answer that, sir. But I will take note.
I would be interested in knowing whether that's something that you're looking at.
Yeah. I think the other thing for that, Representative Greenwich, is there's a protocol that has to be followed for chain of evidence and for actually being able to introduce the evidence. And these scientists actually have to have basically a portfolio showing that they've gone through these rigid trainings, mm-hmm. et cetera. That's part of this is really a part. It's not that they don't have the education to do it. They have to be able to testify that they've met these standards, these qualifications, and gone through all of this stuff. And that's the part. We have that with DREs, which are drug recognition experts, and other individuals that are coming in and giving expert testimony. That is just part of the process to get them to be able to run independent in the lab and then be able to testify and verify that they followed all the scientific standards and all that. That's, I think, the unfortunate part of the longer period before they're on their own.
I can train a brain surgeon in a new technique in less than a year.
Can you qualify him to testify in court? I mean, that's part of that.
Qualify courts him to operate on you. That's almost as important.
Yeah. There's difficulty getting it through there. Yeah. Thank you.
I think of the last thing I did want to put on the record, and this goes back to what Chair Barker said, for anyone that is listening to this, current state law does, in fact, provide that if there is DNA evidence, there is no statute of limitation for the, going forward on those sex ones.
Sex ones, yeah. Okay, anything further? Thank you. Superintendent, then you want to go on about the need for the comprehensive school safety hotline?
Yes, sir. So, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Rich Evans. I'm going to continue on my passion, school safety. In the 2014 legislative session, House Bill 4087 was introduced. It's a task force on comprehensive school safety. The task force is met with, or the folks on the task force, law enforcement, fire personnel, and educators. Our first task, as called out in the House bill, was to develop a request for information to be published by the Oregon State Police to create a hiring, a vendor database for the floor plans and safety protocols for the schools and school response. We have done that. We've worked through that. We've completed an RFI process. We had 5 2-hour panels to make sure that we covered all the school districts and emergency responders across the state of Oregon. We had 31 specific benefits that we believed that were identified in those processes by the task force and our folks out in the field. 7 vendors responded to that request. And even though that the vendors responded, I know that the model that we have asked for, if you can compare it to what Washington has done, the price tag on that was $5.3 million for a 4-year implementation process. I know how general fund dollars are. I've lived general fund every day of my life, and that price tag stepped me back to say, can I do better? And so We didn't start, we didn't stop there. And so we continued to do our research, and we found out that West Virginia Safe Schools, which is a division of the West Virginia Homeland Security, is using a Homeland Security database. It's called HISN, Homeland Security Information Network. And basically, it's a customizable database accessible to law enforcement. It's customizable. It has secure site and password, and you can download the school plans, your database, your photographs, everything for free. And so West Virginia is coming to Oregon next month. We've invited them out to show us what their product is, how they use it, and we believe that from the conversations that I personally had with them, this system will work for Oregon, and it will be free if we choose to go this route. So the next, I'm not sure what task force meeting, I believe it's going to be in November, they will come out and show us how they use it. They implemented it after a legislatively mandated implementation. They found that this system worked for them. It was customizable. It did everything they wanted to do, and the system is free. And it is also a secure site that law enforcement can access, and whoever law enforcement wants to have access to that. The schools in West Virginia, the county emergency management operators have access to the system, and a lot of other folks that need access, fire personnel have access to the system. So for me, obviously, we're not ready to push forward with a $5 million to $10 million request. I want to hear from West Virginia, and if this is the model we go with, I believe that we are in a lot better place for Oregon financially, and we can have the same result. And so even though we've went through this complete RFI request, we have identified the characteristics that we believe we need in a school safety database system, and we believe we can, if everything works out right, we can do that through the HISN system for free. The only thing we would have to pay for would be the folks to enter the data. And it's very clear from Washington's experience and from the West Virginia's experience, you want the same people taking the photographs and the database of the school and entering it so it's all consistent, so you don't have piecemeal and you don't have inconsistent products in different school districts around the state. We didn't stop there, as you'll see. We identified three major areas of focus. The tip line, which I'm going to talk about in just a minute. The threat assessment. Right now in Oregon, you have threat assessment for individual school districts, and Marion County is the national model for threat assessment. When a student starts showing destructive behavior, they have level one, level two, and level three. They have basically a multidisciplinary approach, and they bring in the experts to try to deal with that child at a very low level and make sure that it doesn't escalate. And the Marion County Sheriff's Office, along with their partners, has the model. What the task force found is Marion County is the national leader. There are other counties and other school districts across Oregon where there's absolutely nothing. And so they have destructive behavior by a student, and they're not able to identify or even have the resources and how to deal with that. So we are researching the threat assessment model that is implemented in Marion County, and we're going to bring that forward in future meetings so that we can discuss this, because they've had some great success in Marion County stopping children. It could be anything from bullying to destructive behavior where they're threatening students. It could be bringing weapons to school. It could be sexually explicit issues. It could be anything, and they do a very good job of defusing that. And we want to make sure that every school district in Oregon has that opportunity. So now I'm going to focus on the tip line. This is our number one task force priority. What we've learned in our research is that 81% of the time, somebody else knew that a school shooting was going to occur. And what we're finding is that there's no way really in Oregon to report that. I'm going to talk about Colorado in a minute. Earlier this month, the Oregon State Police, through the Ask the Superintendent Network, we got an email that was forwarded from a chat forum that basically said, was a student at Christian schools growing up. I was bullied. I was I'm going to go get them, and I have weapons, and I'm going to go kill some people. That came through on an email system, and fortunately, we checked that email that morning, and by the afternoon, we had identified that person. That person was a felon with in possession of firearms and had the ability to carry out that threat, and the only way we got that was through an email system. We do not have a system, and the tip line is a system that would help us with that. Go ahead. This is the data report from Colorado. They have a Safe to Tell program. We had a handout for you, but if you look at this, the thing that shocked me the most when I started looking at safety tip lines across the United States, the number one complaint or tip received was on bullying of students. That is the number one tip line, the complaint. There are statistics out there that tell you that anywhere from 28 to 20% of students miss one day of school a month because of bullying and cyberbullying issues within the, within their school districts. As you can see from Colorado, they started this in 2004. They had a 58% yearly increase in reports related on the tip line, and they continue today. As you can see, that number one is bullying, 3,086 reports that were received. But if you look down to guns and weapons and planned school attacks, they've had 381 notifications in Colorado through the tip line to stop those type of an attacks. The tip lines that they have are can come, the complaints or the issues can come in through phone calls, web reports, and even text messages. What the Oregon State Police has done with the assistance of the Safety Task Force is put a RFP together, and we're working on that so that we can come to you in February with a price tag and implementation ask of what the establishing a tip line in Oregon would be, and that's in cooperation with our educator partners. We believe that prevention is a priority over response right now. We believe that if we get this tip line in there, we can do some great work in the schools. We can get folks assistance for suicides, as you'll see, it's on there. There's so many things that are coming through the schools. When we meet with the task force, we have a teacher rep, and the number one issue that she's brought forward is she asks her kids, do you feel safe in school? And a majority of those kids say, at times, I do not feel safe in school. And as a public safety system, if our kids aren't safe in school, we fail. That's my personal opinion. So I'm here to ask, as we move forward with this tip line, as we get the RFP done prior to the February session, we will come back. I can provide the committee with additional information on the how the tip line would work, what a valuable tool it would be, we believe, for Oregon, and it is our number one recommendation to the committee for school safety. We will continue to work on risk assessment and our floor plan data, but we, like I said before, right now this is our priority, and we have a lot of passion when it comes to this group, and it's been I feel like we're accomplishing things, and I'm very proud of the work that they've done. But if we can establish a tip line in Oregon, we had one that was established after the Kinkle shooting, as you remember, and it was assigned to the Department of Justice and cut in budget cuts. To me, this is our priority, and we want to make sure that I appreciate the ability to talk about it today, but we have to keep our kids safe. The Reynolds shooting was a stark reminder of how quickly these things can unfold, and I want to make sure that we are doing everything possible in public safety and our education partners to make the kids safe in Oregon. I'll answer any questions at this time.
Any questions? Thank you very much for your testimony, Superintendent. Appreciate that. Next up is use of restitution authority by the insurance commissioner, Laura Colley and Paul Turdall.
Good afternoon.
Please go ahead. Just identify yourself for the record.
You go in. Sure. And Chair Przanski and Chair Barker, I believe I'm beginning, but just please let me know if you'd like me to go in a different order. Chair Przanski, Chair Barker, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Laura Calley, and I'm the insurance commissioner with the Department of Consumer and Business Services Insurance Division. Thank you all for the opportunity to be in front of you today to provide an update on the consumer protection work that we do within the insurance division, and specifically I'm here to talk about the work that we've done to implement Senate Bill 414, which granted restitution authority to the insurance division, and that was passed by the legislature in 2013. And this is a tool that I'm going to talk to you a little bit about today and help you understand how it's allowed us to get better results for Oregonians who are facing insurance issues. As the insurance regulator for the state, our mission is to empower and protect consumers through fair and efficient regulation while encouraging a financially stable, innovative, and competitive insurance market. We ensure that insurance companies are financially sound so that they can pay claims and make good on the promises that they're making to their policyholders. that consumers are treated fairly when they're policyholders or beneficiaries of insurance policies, and that the rates are reasonable in relationship to the benefits that are being provided by those policies. We use a number of regulatory tools to accomplish this, and they range from licensure of insurance companies and agents, examinations to ensure that the finances are in order, prior approval of rates and forms before they're sold in the market, outreach and education, and also ensuring that the conduct of insurance companies and agents in the market is in compliance with the law. And this is across nearly all lines of insurance across the entire state. For the purposes of today's discussion, I'm going to focus on our oversight of market conduct. And so that's compliance of insurance companies with state and also federal laws in some instances, as well as their filed policies. And that's one of, I think, the important pieces, too, is it's also looking to make sure that they are being consistent with us when they tell us what they're selling in the market. We learn about potential market conduct issues in several ways. Most often, it's coming to us directly from those who are experiencing those issues firsthand. We have a team of experienced consumer advocates who work directly with individuals and businesses who are encountering problems with their insurance. And the advocates are typically the first point of contact for an individual or a business with the insurance division. Our advocates will explain policy language, which can often be complex. They'll mediate miscommunications, and they'll work directly between the consumer or the business who's calling us and the insurance company to do what they can to resolve the issue. And just to note, I'm going to use the term consumer throughout, and generally speaking, we work with individuals as well as businesses who are working with insurance companies, but just for simplicity, I'll use the term consumer, so it really could be a broad range of people that we work with. Before 2014, in addition to resolving issues directly through our consumer advocate team, we had a number of tools available to us, and they ranged from our ability to conduct in-depth investigations of potential violations, assessing civil penalties, and requirements of corrective action. With Senate Bill 414, we are now able to order restitution, order that insurance companies pay restitution to those who are affected by a violation of the law, and that is a tool that we need to use in conjunction with an enforcement action, with a formal action that we take within the division. This tool is extremely important to our ability to protect the public, both by providing the authority to require restitution, but probably most critically, it also provides us with the leverage to negotiate very expedient and favorable resolutions for consumers even prior to the stage where we would take an enforcement action. In fact, the division has been successful in obtaining restitution for consumers at different stages of our regulatory process through the work of the advocates as part of settlement agreements and ultimately through some enforcement actions as well. To give you some idea of the scope of the impact of our work, in 2014, we recovered a total of more than $6.8 million for consumers, and as of September of this year, we've recovered more than $1.8 million for consumers. A significant portion of this is obtained through the work of the advocates that I've already discussed, and in 2014, they resolved more than 3,500 complaints and recovered more than $2.3 million at that initial stage. To date this year, they've already resolved 2,600 complaints and recovered nearly $1.5 million for Oregonians. And every penny of the amount that I mentioned there is going directly to consumers and businesses who were encountering issues, and that was the result of the work that we were able to do to kind of help those individuals resolve issues. And another thing to note here is that these statistics may not include the full extent of some of the work that we do. One of the results that may occur is if a claim were denied initially and we were able to successfully work with an insurance company to get that claim reopened, unless the consumer comes back to us, we may not always know what the final settlement of that would be, but those amounts may not even be figuring in, and they may be even higher than what we have here. To share a couple of examples of the work that's done by the advocates, just last week we had an advocate work with a consumer who had filed a claim for a vehicle he was holding as collateral. And the policyholder, this was the lien holder we were talking to, but the policyholder was not cooperating with the insurance company, and the insurer initially denied the claim. Our advocate got involved and spoke with the insurer and ultimately got the insurer to contact the policyholder, work through issues on the claim, and the ultimate result was that the insurer did pay the claim and the lien holder received $6,500 as a result of the damage to that vehicle. Another example was with an injured party who contacted us just as the statute of limitations was running on an issue, and that person had been in negotiations with the insurance company about a settlement. The injured party was struggling to get a verbal commitment put into writing before that statute ran, and called us right at the, you know, the eve of that deadline. And with our assistance, the consumer was able to get that settlement for $25,000 finalized. While the work of our advocates is critical to resolving consumer issues very quickly, typically within about 30 days, sometimes the issues are a bit more complex and they require further investigation and the possibility of either a larger settlement or enforcement action. When we evaluate whether to go further with additional investigation, we're going to consider whether there is egregious conduct, whether there's a willful or flagrant noncompliance with the law or the policy terms, or if we are seeing that this is a pattern of practice that has maybe a wider scope. In 2014, successful investigations and negotiations resulted in settlements of more than $4.6 million, in addition to what I talked about coming through the consumer advocacy channel. And again, these were amounts directly reimbursed to consumers and businesses. Year to date, that amount is about $360,000, and we still have cases that we are continuing to work in 2015. To give you an idea of the nature of some of the examples that had escalated to investigation and resulted in a settlement, last year we investigated a case where an insurer charged a policyholder a higher premium because that person came from a different insurance company known for insuring high-risk people. And they charged them a higher premium. And that was actually, that was not consistent with the premiums that they had filed with our office. Our investigation revealed that this was actually a much broader issue. And the company agreed to reimburse their affected customers almost $300,000 and corrected their rating structure. Another insurer was found to be using unfiled rates. The insurance companies are required to file with us before they go to the market and make sure that their rates are sound. And we had one company that had not filed their rates and they were charging them in the market. They actually discovered the error and self-reported to us. And they made the corrective action. They agreed to reimburse their customers and make the situation right. In 2015, this year, we found that another insurer had incorrectly charged consumers for medical services that actually should have been covered entirely by the policy, and they were posting them against the consumer's deductible, making the consumer pay them out of pocket. When we discovered this issue, the insurer agreed this had been adjudicated in error, and we did further investigation and found again that this was a broader issue and that there was a billing system issue. And the insurer agreed to fix their billing system and repaid its affected customers over $250,000 that they should not have billed them. We've also been successful in making recoveries for businesses. As I mentioned before, we don't just work with individual consumers. A couple of quick examples. We had some medical providers that were not being reimbursed directly by insurance companies. Instead, they were being told by an insurance company to turn around and bill their customers, and that the insurance company was paying the policyholder directly. That's not usually how it works. And the company agreed to repay the providers over $750,000. We also had a group of agents that was not being paid sufficient commissions, and the insurance company agreed to pay nearly $3 million in underpaid commissions to those agents. And if we're not able to successfully negotiate a settlement at that early stage, or if the issue is egregious enough that we need to take it to enforcement, we have that ability to take it to a formal action. With the formal action, we can assess a civil penalty in addition to requiring remediation and, of course, restitution. And as we continue, we have several pending cases that are in this stage where we are considering whether to go forward with enforcement action. And restitution is certainly a tool that we are considering with each of these cases as we determine the final resolution. And it's an important tool, not just about making consumers whole, but also discouraging other insurance companies from making similar practices in the market. In closing, Senate Bill 414 gave us a very powerful tool that is actively helping us resolve consumers' issues every single day. The deterrent effect of that tool represents a really significant part of its strength, and it is providing us leverage at earlier stages in our regulatory process, in addition to having it as an enforcement tool. And we believe that we're seeing the results in the small and the large resolutions that we have been able to to obtain for businesses and Oregonians, and we're seeing this actually go back into individuals and businesses' pockets. The money is actually going there. As we continue to monitor the conduct of the market, continue with our ongoing investigations, it's likely that we'll have a more explicit use of the restitution tool. But I think it's really important to stress that this is just a portion of the general work that we do on behalf of consumers, and that there are other ways in addition to going all the way to an enforcement action to order restitution that we can be helpful. And with that, I'm happy to answer any questions that you may have.
Any questions? A compliment, comment that I wish that was in effect about a decade earlier. Mm. I have an issue, please.
Thank you, Chair Barker, Chair Pruzanski. My name is Paul Tredal, and I'm actually the author of Senate Bill 414. I developed this bill several years ago, partly based on experience that I had as a consumer submitting consumer complaints, and also feedback that I had with Commissioner Savage, Laura Kelly's predecessor, in terms of what he thought would be helpful and constructive in terms of working through that. I got into this because I have a couple of young boys with autism, and I had a number of issues involving getting insurance coverage for them. And as I personally developed success in helping in resolving my own kids' concerns, I began just helping my friends and families, and I think I'm well over 100 different families that I have helped at various stages of insurance appeals. I really, really appreciate a lot of the help that the Commissioner Cowley and her team have given in working through a lot of those issues. And I definitely see that the people at the insurance division, they come to work every day wanting to help consumers, and that is very helpful. There have been some.
You can help me with that.
There we go. Great. So, just specifically in terms of what Senate Bill 414 did, it added this clause into the enforcement provision. And so, as Commissioner Kelly said, this is only available as part of a formal enforcement action. And what it did is it basically gave the commissioner the authority to seek restitution for actual damages the consumer suffers as a result of the violation. And, when we look at that, I just want to give an example of the kind of impacts that can exist. So this is a real story, based on a consumer complaint that was filed a couple of years ago and is still pending enforcement action. We had a child was diagnosed with autism and recommended intensive ABA therapy. And previously, we had a number of cases with several different insurers where the insurer came back and said, well, if that's just not medically necessary, your doctor's wrong. And in all of those cases, we had been successful with the insurance division's help to get outside medical experts to point to say, no, actually, the doctor was right all along. That is necessary, and you got to cover it. And so what this insurer did is they didn't use that because they knew it wasn't going to work. And so what they did is they basically said that, well, your provider is not qualified for this service. And by the way, we don't have any other providers who are either. And it happened that the provider was approved by DHS, which met the legal requirements under Oregon's Mental Health Parity Statute for insurance reimbursement, and was also expressly grandfathered under Senate Bill 365 to practice ABA and be reimbursed by insurance for it. And so the insurance division's consumer advocacy unit contacted the insurer on behalf of this consumer and said, by the way, you really can't do this. I mean, this denial really is not right. You really have to pay this. And the insurer refused. The insurer said, we will not comply without a written order. And ultimately, that came about 4 months later. About 40 pages of documents came out of the insurance division with bulletins and a lengthy supporting opinion from the Department of Justice that expressly took apart the insurance division's basis for that and said, hey, you can't do that. But, you know, in the meantime, I mean, this kid went without care for a year. And, you know, I mean, the family, there's the next slide, you know, I won't read it to you, has a letter from the parent describing the impact this has had on them. You know, they had to sell their house. They had to sell their car to pay for treatment that should have been covered. They still couldn't afford the level of treatment that they needed. And so the kid lost the opportunity for the level of care that should have been provided under the insurance plan. And the family ended up having to quit their job in Central Oregon, move to Portland to get a new employer that had an insurance plan that was willing to comply with the law. And, you know, there are real impacts that happened to this family because of the insurer's, you know, failure to comply and refusal to listen to the consumer advocacy unit. And, you know, this is an issue that remains active. I mean, I'm happy to say the kid is now getting care, but there's a lot of ground that needs to be made up because of this, and it is still pending in enforcement, and it may be an example that, you know, someday when restitution is done, you know there may be some here. And, you know, as, you know, Commissioner Kelly mentioned, you know, a lot of the purpose of this is to create a deterrent effect so that insurers, when they do something like this, stop and think, you know, not merely am I hurting this child, I may be hurting my bottom line because I may have to pick up the pieces. So that was really why we did this. In terms of the enforcement, you know, Commissioner Kelly described a lot of her success in terms of the Consumer Advocacy Unit for, you know, working and getting voluntary compliance. Actual enforcement actions are pretty rare. I went through all of the enforcement, marketplace enforcement actions that have been issued since 1998. In the healthcare market, there have been two in the last 4 years. Most of the issues over time have been related to things like selling insurance to unauthorized groups or some procedural issues. There have been only a handful in the last 17 years that have resulted from, you know, actual enforcement actions resulting from an insurer not complying with insurance mandates or things like that. And, you know, there are, I think, a number of things that go into this. As Commissioner Kelly mentioned, most of these consumer complaints are resolved in a relatively timely fashion. But when you get into more complicated ones, there are really no laws or administrative rules out there describing this process. You know, there are statutes describing that the insurance commissioner has to receive and record complaints and write an annual report. There's really nothing that requires actual investigation. They do it. There's nothing that requires it. And there's no transparent process where the consumers can understand, here's where I am in this process, here's what are the roadblocks, and here's where I'm going. So the consumer I just mentioned, their complaint was almost 2 years ago. They haven't heard much. There are, I think, several dozen families in a similar situation, you know, that are waiting action. And in many of these cases, the insurance division has really been encouraging consumers to basically retain their own counsel and pursue their own litigation rather than waiting. Insurance division is also under a significant amount of pressure not to take strict action. While the insurance division has been using this as a tool for motivation, it has never actually ordered actual restitution under the statute. And, you know, one of the reasons for it, I was listening to the recordings of the Rules Advisory Committee meetings earlier this week. And, you know, here's an example of a quote from one of the insurers in one of those Rules Advisory Committee meetings, basically saying, you know, one of the consumers that you're stating you want to protect is going to be tied up in court for 3 years. I guarantee that because I will be the plaintiff. This is what they were saying if the insurance division actually ordered, you know, substantial restitution under that statute. There's a lot of resistance from the insurers that the insurance commissioner has to think about in terms of actually, you know, pulling the trigger and going ahead. There have also been, some political pressure in terms of this. And, you know, on the autism issue, you know, we have been asking the insurance division for enforcement assistance since the mental health parity statute was passed in 2006. And a couple of years ago, after some back and forth, the insurance division began telling us, you know what, we get it now. We think you're right. And Commissioner Savage told me, you know, we think you're right. We think that the therapy you're looking for really was already required in our essential benefits package. And I have here an email that Rocky King sent to the governor's office and legislative fiscal office, basically saying that and saying that they were looking into the details. And that was based on some private litigation that a consumer did against Pacific Source, which is the benchmark plan. And you know, they won. Pacific Source is ordered to pay for this. And Pacific Source, you know, even had a press release in early 2013, which I've got up here, just describing their improved access to that benefit on the benchmark plan. But you know, nonetheless, you know, right after you know, CoverOrg and the insurance division basically were saying, yeah, you know, we think you're right. The governor's office intervened. They basically had a meeting with the head of Pacific Source, and the head of Pacific told them that they were only providing this benefit due to a lawsuit, and because they were only doing it because of a lawsuit, they didn't really think it should be required for coverage. And so, on that basis, you know, we were basically told, you know, we weren't going to get, you know, there with enforcement until we pursued our own private litigation against insurers, and that's what we did. You know, we had a very carefully constructed suit against Providence in district court, and you know, we got a ruling on summary judgment a year later, which basically said that you know, you can't purport to cover autism as required by mental health parity without, you know, without covering this treatment. And that was on summary judgment, meaning that the judge found that there was no genuine dispute as to any material fact, and no rational trier of fact could find for the insurer in that case. And we had tried to work through this. The insurance division was telling us they thought we were right, and they basically got overruled, and we basically had to put a lot of this on ice while we were doing that. So as recommendations, I think we need a transparent and efficient process to adjudicate these consumer complaints. When advocacy breaks down, we need to have a process consumers and insurers can work with the insurance division to be more formal in terms of addressing the complaint, making a decision on a timely manner, and getting some decisions about whether this was in violation of the law or not. It would be helpful if consumers had the ability to get help from an advocate or a family member when they're working the complaints process. Currently, the insurance division will only talk to the actual consumer. And then, in cases, in some of these complicated cases where there are serious violations of the law, consumers really do need the ability to do what the insurance division is encouraging them to do, and that is take these cases to court when the insurance division is unable to act. So, thank you.
Any questions?
Two quick questions.
Okay, please.
First of all, Senator, on a private suit, does the plaintiff have a right to recover attorney fees?
You know, it's funny. My own plan says they don't, but just the other week I found a clause in the insurance code that says that I do. And so I discussed that with the insurance division this morning, and I'll be looking through that. So there is a statute that I can see that says that if you sue and you get more than the insurance company was offering, you do get them. And I need to understand with the insurance division how that is working, because my plan is they don't get that.
Okay. And the last question is for the commissioner. I just want to verify what I thought I heard you say, and what I've heard that Peter say, is that the enforcement tool of restitution has not been used since it's been enacted in 2013, from the 2013.
Chair Przanski, yes, that's correct. That we have not taken a formal enforcement action to order restitution. Yes, that's correct.
And then to follow up on that, is that because you have been threatened by any carriers telling you that if you do that, they're going to tie you up in litigation over that statute?
Chair Przanski, no, that is absolutely not the case, and we will absolutely consider using that as a tool in any case that we think it's useful and necessary. And so I attended some of those rulemaking meetings, and I know that there was a lot of controversy. Thinking about how we would use restitution, what we would consider to be damages, and I think probably some hesitancy on the part of some parties. But it's an important tool, and we intend to consider its use for any case where it may make sense.
Thank you.
Thank you very much. Appreciate it. We're going to jump out of order. The next one I'm going to call and the changes in definition of victim from the parole board hearing process.
Kristen. Mr. Chair, thank you for hearing that. I think this will be a shorter one, so she won't wait to do the,
that's what,
the next one.
And committee, we're not going to be able to go into very into a lot of very specific things about some of these cases, but we'll get an overview, so please.
Thank you. Chair Barker, Chair Brzezanski, members of the committee. My name is Christy Winges-Yanez. I'm the chair of the Board of Parole, and I thank you for the invitation to speak today about a recent rule change that we made regarding how we define victim for our processes. I was appointed to the board in December of 2012, and this really was an early goal of mine. It had been an issue before my time on the board. And it's a rare situation that our the scope of our victim definition comes up, but even in one case where there is an exclusion, it's really one case too many for the board. So for the past 2 years, we worked on language. It was a really slow process involving meeting with different stakeholders. We got input from the National Crime Victims Law Institute and other folks, and we had a really in-depth legal review as well. Our goal was to be as inclusive as possible while maintaining the integrity and the fairness of all of our processes. And it is board hearings that are the most public area of our work, but the board has numerous other processes that apply to all the 15,000 offenders that are on supervision and involving setting supervision conditions in other areas. So I do want to note that our hearings are already public and anyone can attend, and this really is about services and about making statements at those hearings. So also important to note, since 2012, the board's had another rule. We call it our other relevant witness rule, and that is a rule that we use broadly. I sent in a handout with some of the rule language so that I don't have to read it out to you today, but you do have that. But that rule allows the chairperson of the board to designate other folks who can speak at our hearings based on information that they may have for us. And it's the board's job to give that information the weight that's appropriate for each case, and that's what we do. We decide how much weight to give each bit of information. So other relevant witnesses get the same amount of time to speak at board hearings, but they're not designated as victims. An example of folks we've designated as other relevant witnesses are like the police detective on the case. If 30 years later they want to come in and speak at the hearing, that's absolutely somebody we want to hear from. Also, we have used this rule in the past for victims of unconvicted cases. So that's really what we were using, that and the old victim definition. That brings us to the new definition, which after all of this work, we proposed in April and did the standard formal rulemaking process. We did vote the new definition on July 27th of this year, and it became immediately effective. That the new definition now includes victims whose cases were maybe pled out or cases that were just connected to the case. That's the case before the board. And it's the board's job to determine what credible information we have or information that we can ask for from the district attorney to substantiate that those people are in fact related to the case. And there's another bill that passed, there was a bill that passed in 2015, that's House Bill 3036, which gives us a mechanism to ask the district attorneys for information. So we do plan to use that mechanism going forward. We've used the new definition once so far. Just to give you an example of when this might come up, a person was connected to an offender by marriage. The pre-sentence investigation in our file included information that the offender admitted the victimization, and we had criminal justice information about that in the record as well. So we designated the individual as a victim. Now, that person didn't actually want to speak at our hearing, but did want to participate in other ways. So we have used it in that way.
So again, the goal here was inclusion. It's truly important to the board. Our processes are incredibly challenging and emotional. And if someone wants to participate in that process and wants to provide us information, then we want to hear from them. And it's really also, in addition to it being about information, it's really about trust as well. When folks are involved in our processes, they really trust the system more. And I think, you know, we're really happy with the rule and the process that we engaged in to write it, and we're happy. We've gotten really positive feedback as well. So any questions that you have, again, thank you for the opportunity to just come do a little education about this.
Well, thank you very much for coming in. Any questions? Thank you. I really appreciate you
coming
this afternoon. Okay. We'll move on to the final item on the agenda today, the report from the Advanced Directive Work Group. Stephanie Carter, Woodruff English, please.
Limit them to 15 minutes so we get out early.
Yeah. Okay. You can please go ahead and start. We're going to need to be done here in about 15 minutes today. So.
Chair Przanski, Chair Barker, committee members, thank you for allowing me to come and speak with you today about the advance directive. My name is Stephanie Carter, and I am an estate planning and elder law attorney in Lake Oswego, Oregon. I've been serving on the work group representing the estate planning and elder law sections of the bar. The work group was formed under the leadership of Senator Przanski, and we've been working with Chan Newell, the committee administrator. And the group has grown from an original 15 people to 35. The committee represents the health networks, nonprofits, including AARP, Decisions Oregon, as well as the Oregon State Bar, the Oregon Medical Association, physicians, ethicists. We've been trying to be as inclusive as possible on that committee. There's been a lot of language confusion when we've worked in the committee. When we refer to an advance directive, it's important to understand that that term grasps two important parts of the form that serve two completely different purposes. Part B of the form is the appointment of a healthcare representative. Part C of the form is providing healthcare instructions about what a person wants to do at the end of life. We were the first state to have an advance directive statute, and it hasn't been changed since that time. If you ask anyone who works with this form, I'm sure that I'm not exaggerating when I say they hate it. It is a horrible form. It's confusing. It contains ambiguities that lead to that confusion. It focuses on tube feeding and ventilation, which, as our colleagues in the medical profession have educated us, aren't necessarily the major health incidents that face the healthcare representative and the physician when they're making a decision about care. It's meant to be used by someone who's 18 through end of life. So the questions that are included in Part C don't necessarily even touch upon things that an 18-year-old might be worried about. Because they're not facing end of life in the imminent future. So this form needs to be changed. Where we've come up against some stumbling blocks is how to change the form, what our statute should look like in the end of this process. As I said, the form's confusing. There's limited ability to customize the form. There are places where people can insert their wishes in broader language. People don't tend to use that because there's no prompts or questions that would help them think about what they should be saying in that section. There's no statement or value of values or beliefs unless some attorneys have things that they insert for different communities. For example, there's a statement from Jehovah's Witnesses about blood transfusions that routinely can be put into the advance directive in those sections. It's not easily entered into the medical records. Okay. So we want to fix some of these problems that we come up against. One thing that's become clear on the work group is that there's a lot of different users. You know, we think about the signer. You know, that's the consumer. There's the healthcare representatives, who are often families and friends who are going to have to interpret this form. Primary care providers, attorneys like me who are working on them, ethicists who are dealing with situations that arise in the hospital where there's a dispute between maybe what the doctor wants and the healthcare representative believes they should be doing, and the different groups that advocate for the elderly. So all of these people use this form. You know, in an average week, I probably help 10 clients complete this form as an attorney. So, you know, I have a vested interest because I hear from my clients every day the concerns they have. So we started by sending out a survey to the elder law, estate planning, health law sections of the bar. Got a really good turnout, 280 responses. And then that survey was slightly revised and sent out to the medical community, received 55 responses. The first question that we asked was, what should we have? And 73% of the physicians who responded and 70% of the attorneys who responded said we should have a single statutory form. The other options were to list the minimum requirements in statute, but not have a statutory form, or keep the healthcare appointment of that representative in form, have the instructions be outside of the statute with just minimum requirements set out. So we gave them different options, and they chose the single statutory form. So a smaller group, after reviewing forms from many different states, met to determine what are the key elements for the section of the form that appoints a healthcare representative. And we came back to the committee with the form that I believe you've been provided with. Is that correct?
Who do we have it for?
Chair Barker, Chair Przanski, members of the committee. The form is on OLIS. It is a draft advance directive, very bare bones, minimum of what would be contained in statute. You also have included there the current advance directive, so you can compare them side by side. They are on OLIS.
So the portion of the form that appoints the healthcare representative is very bare bones. We tried our best to take it down to a language level that someone with a lower level of, you know, 6th to 8th grade would be able to understand. It just appoints the healthcare representatives, it has them sign, and it goes on from there. So it's very bare bones. It eliminates the questions that are on the current form that cause a great deal of confusion about, can my healthcare representative make this decision or this decision? And it referred the reference to the instructions that exist now. So it's very bare bones. It's a uniform appointment that could be made. There's no ambiguity in it. It's just straight, these are the people who should act for me if I need someone to communicate for me. And I think Dr. English has the next section of it.
I'm starting where?
The questions.
And remember to introduce yourself for the record, please.
I shall introduce myself? Sure. My name is Woody English. I'm a retired palliative care physician here in Oregon. And I'm working currently actively in many aspects of the community to promote advanced care planning, goals of care conversations in clinical settings. One of the organizations I'm working with is the Oregon Health Leadership Council, and in that regard, I'm co-chair of their Advanced Care Practices Committee, which has encouraged me to participate in this process.
Okay, thank you. And you, I know you were out plugging your meter, so we're asking that we wrap up by 5 till.
Oh, sure.
Okay, no, thank you. Please go ahead.
Be happy to. So I want to report back on the work that we've been doing in our large and small groups. And firstly, I really want to emphasize that I think there's been very engaging dialogue and collegial working on various members of the committee. We've come to it with differing opinions about some of the details of this, but we all agree that the current statutory form for the Oregon Advanced Directive needs to be changed. And it needs to be changed additionally because it's confused with the POLST, the Physician's Order for Life-Sustaining Treatment, which historically came after the Advanced Directive and does a very good job at identifying when life support and life prolonging care is given, and it's a physician's order and is embedded into the medical record. This created a very clear role for the Advanced Directive, which should help all citizens find a person, a healthcare representative, to speak on their behalf. Healthcare is so complicated that if you are not able to communicate, somebody needs to assist you in that. And the Oregon Advanced Directive also provides what we call the instructions or some guidance for that healthcare representative. The healthcare representative appointment is relatively straightforward, and Stephanie's done a good job of leading us to that point. The issue around the instructions part, however, does not fit very nicely into a statutory form at all. In fact, really needs to be more proscriptive in its approach in creating some official status for that rather than being very, very detailed. And to be truly helpful to both the healthcare representative for whom the instructions are pointed and to healthcare providers who may, in fact, see the instructions, the instructions need to be values-based. They need to be focused on things that are important to an individual, and they need to be able to fit any number of circumstances. For example, someone who's still healthy but has an accident is very different from somebody who's in the last stages of cancer who then gets an infection in terms of the kinds of health care that might seem appropriate and what the goals of that health care should be in terms of restoring somebody to function or easing somebody with comfort. So at this point, the main issue we have, I think, is to help us establish the appropriate kind of governance to work through these details of how flexible this document ends up being to address many different clinical situations rather than having it actually directed, because that's the problem with the current form. It's so detailed that it is no longer incredibly useful as we once thought it was. And therefore, to create a replacement for that, that really needs flexibility. It also needs to be able to grow and change as technology and environments shift. For example, there's a real interest to be able to take this product and now make it available to an electronic medical record so it will appear in the emergency department, in the outpatient urgency center, into the hospital and the critical care units, as well as freestanding physician's office. The electronic medical record would allow that to happen, and we have to engage in that technology as we develop this. Some of the technology isn't fully mature right now, so it's foolish in our minds to be so proscriptive that we can't flex again. So keeping it out of these details out of the statute makes incredibly good sense to all of us. With that, I'm going to stop my point and not go any further, but entertain any questions.
Okay. Any questions?
Mr. Chair.
Representative Greenlee.
Yeah, I don't exactly have a question. I just want to make a statement about this. I really think having an advance directive form in a statute makes no sense at all. And I'm not even convinced that an advance directive form needs to be in existence. It seems to me the importance is naming somebody to represent me when these decisions need to be made. I recently gave my son a power of attorney for financial matters for me. There wasn't a form for that in the statute, nor was there an additional form I had to fill out that said, okay, with my checking account, if I have more than $100, you can do this. If I have less than $100, you can do that. Here's how I want you to pay the bills. I gave him the power of attorney with the assumption that he would know what it was I wanted, would act on my behalf and my best interest. If there is an advance directive form, it seems to me I ought to be able to write my instructions on the back of a napkin and have that serve as my instructions. But the real issue is to have a conversation between me and the person I assigned to make these decisions. And that seems to me where information about what has to happen ought to be enforced. We're going to really lose the battle if we try and supplement or replace the very bad form that's in statute now with another form that will end up being very bad. I'm not even convinced that you need a two-page form for the assignment of my representative, which is being proposed now. I mean, it seems to me it ought to be a very simple thing. Yeah. Person X, I name person X to make all healthcare decisions on my behalf, and I'm unable to make them myself. That's all there is to it.
Chair Posansky, Chair Barker, Representative Greenlick, I think you have said exactly how many of us feel it should be going. And some people imagine the instructions actually being a selfie and doing it in video and being able somehow to incorporate that. And that technology needs to be worked out. It needs to be something that we can trust. And that's why we need some protection and structure. And to get to that point, I think our work group needs to figure out an appropriate governance for this whole process. And that's what we intend to go back and continue to work on and bring that back to you.
Thank you. May I also respond,
sure,
Representative Greenlink? Most of the states that allow other alternatives, whether it's a kind of a national form or something somebody's written on a napkin, have something in statute that you might call a safe harbor form, so that I, as an attorney, can go to that statute and sit down with a client, and I, at least minimum for the appointment of a healthcare representative, I have a set form that can easily be entered in the medical records that is absolutely clear that they're appointing it, that it is appropriately witnessed or notarized. And because, you know, you talked about doing a financial power of attorney. Do you know the problems in my practice I have every single day with powers of attorney, because every lawyer and Stevens Ness have their own version of it, and title companies and banks and investment companies all have their own interpretation of what the words on the page mean. So I beg this committee that if we offer legislation, at minimum we must have some kind of safe harbor form in statute. And personally, I'd love to see the healthcare representative appointment be mandatory. The instructions, you know, they're more free form. Someone like me, I want to be able to check the box and say, don't keep me alive. Someone else, maybe Dr. English, might want to have open-ended questions that they can express all these values and beliefs. I'm not that touchy-feely. So we represent the general population and that broad span of people who need to give instructions. But people need some kind of form that they can start with and be prompted to make some instructions. So at least, otherwise, you know, if I don't have a safe harbor form, what form do I use when I sit down with my clients to discuss this issue? I might, you know, Kaiser might adopt one form, Providence might adopt another. There's the five wishes form. It becomes this confusion of forms, and each of them has their own language and creates ambiguities, and then I end up in court either defending someone who made a decision based upon those instructions or fighting to have them enforced because there's ambiguity.
Let me comment on that. I think the statute ought to define the characteristics of that form. It seems to me that's the safe harbor. It's saying a form ought to have this, and this when it comes to the appointment of a healthcare representative. But I don't think I should have to go to an attorney to figure out how to do that. I think if Stevens Ness has a form, I ought to be able to use it. If Kaiser has a form, I ought to be able to use it. It isn't that hard, it seems to me, to represent somebody, I mean to name somebody, to represent me in healthcare decisions when I can't make them. On the other hand, I don't think we need this advance directive form. I think that's where the problem is. And you might, again, put into statute a set of principles that would define the form that somebody might want to write for themselves. But this should not, I should not have to go to an attorney to do the simple matter of telling my healthcare system who I want to make my decisions when I'm not able to make it myself. I understand that attorneys hate ambiguity, although that's what keeps you working. But I think we need to simplify this, not complicate it. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Okay, thank you. And committee, we've reached the end of the day, so thank you very much for your testimony on this, and we'll close the hearing.
Sentence closed.
Thank you.